extending it for 2 years. You'll see on page 23, on 23.31, they were set to expire on December 31st, 2010. The Senate has...
I believe the tape is rolling now, so I just want to say for the record, we're on the conference committee on Senate File 3275, Saturday, May 8th, or whatever today is, and going through the side-by-side. Please continue, Mr. Canato.
Madam Chair, that's a Senate-only provision extending that Metropolitan Area Water Supply Advisory Committee. And then, if you look on the bottom, the House did their...
Excuse me. Representative Wiginius.
Clarification. I just am not understanding. Is this new language or just an extension of a time?
Madam Chair, Representative Wiginius, it's just extension of a time. If you look on 23.31, you'll see that the advisory committee is currently set to expire on December 31st, 2010. And what this does is gives them another 2 years.
Representative Wiginius.
I'm just to clarify again, if it's just set to expire, why is all the language repeated then?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Wiginius, yeah. Because we have to put the language in to make the change, because it's in that subdivision 2, and so you have to see all of subdivision 2, because the date change is on 23.31. But it's, Madam Chair, Representative Wiginius, none of it's underlined, so it's existing law. It's just the date change.
I see what you're saying now. Okay.
And Madam Chair, I think we'll ignore the bottom of page R25. The House did a little different style on the Clean Water Fund appropriations than the Senate, and that just reflects that. On R26, the Senate allows $145,000 of the money for best management practices to be used to complete the work of the Agency for the Prevention of Water from Polycyclic Aromatic Hydrocarbons. The House does it a little different. They actually amended that section of law and added $5 million, it looks like. I'll let, I think Ms. Taylor explain how the House did that. They also do this, but they do some other things, too.
You'll see the corresponding provision on R29. If you look at the House side, 31.25 through 31.28, this is where the additional $145,000 comes in. And then there's also an extra $200,000 that gets put into the grant program for the stormwater cleanup that you'll see, and that's on R28, 31.11. And then there's some other changes on line 31.30. An additional $200,000 went into the Lower St. Louis River restoration project.
Ms. Taylor, okay, you jumped ahead from R26. Is there anything we need to see on 26, 27, or 20? I guess on 28 I see a change in a number. Is that the first one?
Yeah, that's the first one. The rest of it's just old language being brought in.
Madam Chair, some of these changes will probably be clear when we go through the spreadsheet.
Yeah.
This is just the language that kind of does it, so.
Okay, that's fine.
And continue.
Yeah. And then the next change would be on R30. You'll see paragraph M is getting struck. This is that $5 million that set aside from the Clean Water Fund that we did last year. This is getting taken out, and I believe both the House and the Senate do spend it later on. But this is just removing it here.
Madam Chair, the Senate just basically does a cross-reference to this law rather than striking language. And if you look on the bottom of page R31, there's a Senate-only provision on the high-resolution digital elevation data, extending it until June 30th, 2012. And then, Madam Chair, the Clean Water Fund appropriations, we can go through this more carefully in the spreadsheet, but you'll see that both sides do appropriate money for the water quality standards, and then also the $5 million for the groundwater monitoring in the 11-county area. The House does have some additional language on 25.22 to 25.25. Just point that out at this point in time. The Senate also on Section 5 of H.R. 32 has another $500,000 to the Metropolitan Council to continue their water supply planning activities. And then on page R33, the Senate has an appropriation for water quality projects, $100,000 each year to Bowser for grants to the Star Lake Ward, and then we'll get some house-only provisions.
Yeah, on the bottom of R33, you'll see the appropriation for Bowser, and what the House did was they took three separate appropriations and put it into three different programs that the Bowser got money for last session, for the riparian buffers, the grants to watershed districts and WMOs for vegetative management practices and other.
Mr. Knopf, go back and tell us where the Star Lake language is, please.
So, Madam Chair, it's on R33, top of, and it's section 6 on the Senate side.
R33? I don't see it on R33.
R33 on the Senate side.
Oh, I'm sorry, Senate side. There we go.
And
we did change that from last year, but we can talk about that.
And Madam Chair, maybe the House can talk about D and E.
Continuing with the Bowser appropriations, the last one is on the bottom of R34. There's $500,000 more dollars for the wellhead protection conservation easements. And then on R35, the House did have a Star Lake Board provision. It just requires the board to provide some recommendations to Bowser on criteria that could be used for Star Lakes or Star Rivers. And then on E, this is similar to what we've done in the past, is allowing them to use some up to 5% for administration of the grant program. And then our 35 on the bottom is this beginning of Article 3 on the House side. Section 1 would require the legislative auditor to do restoration audits and on the four constitutionally dedicated funds. Section 2 is...
This is restoration audits for land restoration, but funded by any legacy funds, even the arts and cultural heritage, if they do. But it only applies to land restoration. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Madam Chair, you made the comment that it applies only to those funds, but it does say funded with state funds, including the Outdoor Heritage Fund, so it actually does go a little beyond that on 34.28.
Okay. All right, Section 2 is another provision. This is related to the audits that the legislative auditor would do. These are financial audits of the funds like they do for all other state funds, and this just provides a provision for billing back the work to the four constitutional funds.
Do you have a dollar amount attached to this?
It.
In your spreadsheet? Okay, we'll get to that later then.
Section 1?
And Section 3 is the beginning of us. Beginning of a series of changes that just codify the logo requirement that we passed last session, and these provisions just clean up some language and just codify it so it's clear. And that's Section 4, Section 5, Section 6, and Section 6, and then Section 7 allows funds to be carried over for the four funds from last year. Section 8 is a provision that would allow the Minneapolis Park and Rec Board to acquire property from the Scherer Brothers Lumberyard with Parks and Trails funds. And then Section 9 is a repeal of the legislative requirement for a 25-year plan.
A repeal of which requirement for a 25-year plan?
A 25-year plan for the legacy funds. It's the legislative plan. That passed.
Mr. Madam Chair, it's the provision that you carried at the conference last year with the where it has the each group that makes recommendation is supposed to have a 25-year plan, strategic plan, by next January.
And so this repeals that.
This repeals that, Madam Chair.
Mr. Chair, I think
we have the language that's the repealer language in here somewhere.
Yeah. Madam Chair, this at the end, as each group completes a 25-year plan, language that envisioned that the LCC and the legislature would adopt a legislative overarching 25-year plan that encompassed all four and put a legislative, I guess, overarching plan on in place. This repeals that legislative requirement. The four 25-year plans completed by each of the individual funds would still exist. It's just that the legislature would not spend the entire next interim merging those plans into a legislative 25-year plan.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'd make it even clearer, I hope. Last year, you had planned various plans that were funded through the University of Minnesota and for the parks and trails and for the clean water. Those are all still in place, but this was your general provision that said that all groups who are making recommendations will have a 25-year strategic plan.
Well, I guess I need to see the language because it's a little...
We'll get the language for you.
Madam Chair, I guess that moves us to Article 3 on the Senate side. The first provision is the same on both sides, Section 1, but the House has something different in Section 2.
Madam Chair, this is a House-only provision from Representative Portman's bill. It establishes a permitting goal of 150 days for the DNR. On R2, there's a sort of technical DNR provision that allows them to sell gift cards and safety training certificates through their ELS system. And that's the same. The Section 4 and Section 3 on the Senate House are the same.
Ms. Taylor, I don't know if I'm getting old, but I'm really having trouble hearing you. Please try to speak.
Sure.
I know in this room the acoustics are really bad, so
sure.
Thank you.
On page R3, Section 4 on the Senate and Section 5 on the House side are the same. Section 6 is one of two provisions related to the utility crossing. The House has a provision that would allow an applicant to kind of bundle their applications for a utility license so they could pay the application fee once. And then Sections 5 and 7, the House changes both the fee for the public water crossings and the public land crossings to $2,000, and the Senate changes just the public land down to $1,000. And then the House has a provision you'll see on R4 on lines 5.23 through 5.27 that just requires that if the fees don't collect enough money that they reduce their efforts so that there isn't a fiscal impact.
And Madam Chair, if you look on the bottom page, R4, this off-highway vehicle seasonal restrictions, the only difference there is the Senate continues on 2.28.7 outside the seasons prescribed by this paragraph. The House strikes that, and then the House makes it effective the day following final enactment. Otherwise, I think those are identical. And Madam Chair, on R5, there are some provisions from Senator Kubley's bill that were brought in, and you'll see that Section 1 on the exemptions for the Indian tribal government, that has already passed the Senate, so the House is actually carrying it in their bill, but it just, but they are, you'll see that they're identical. Section 7 on the Senate and 10 on the House, as I understand it, the language is on the next page is the same except for the effective date. The House has it following enactment. Another registration for Indian tribal governments in Section 11 on the House. Section 8 and 12 deal with the one-time registration fee. Those are the same. Section 3, the next one is the Indian tribal government. That's again brought from Senator Kubley's bill. Section 9 and Section 14 on page R7 of this side-by-side have the collector snowmobile, and if I understand it, that's the same. Page R7, the sticker requirement, that's again related to the Indian tribal government, to machines that are owned by them. That's on page R8. Those are the same. The all-terrain vehicle definitions on 10 and 11 in the Senate, 16 and 17 in the House are the same. Again, Section 5 and Section 18 are dealing with the Indian tribal government exemption. They're the same. Section 12 and page R9, Section 12 and Section 19 are the same. And the fee for registration, again, is a one-time fee on the bottom of page R9. Those provisions are the same. Section 14 and 21 on page R10 are identical, as I understand it. And then sections 15 and 22 are identical, except for 22 has that immediate effective date on page R11 and 12.25 on the House side. Look on page R12 now. Again, this is dealing with ATVs, and the House has an immediate effective date on 13.14. And then section 17 on the Senate and section 24 on the House, as I understand it, are the same. Those are the Part D and our recommended language. Section 18 and section 25 on the House and Senate side, dealing with youth and contests. That's the same, except for, the House has the day following final enactment. And then the House has some House-only provisions in section 26.
You'll see on R15, subdivision 4, persons leaving public waters. This would extend the current requirement to drain your boats that applies to invasive waters now if you leave any public water. And then on section 27, it's just some cleanup language that would be required for that.
Ms. Taylor, we saw similar language in the Senate, but there was an additional fine. Is that in here?
No, the fine has been kept the same this time.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think they were increasing the fine on the Senate side. But if you see on the House, they do have the civil penalty would still be applied to the persons leaving water because of the change on 16.5 to 16.7, but it doesn't increase the fine.
And we did not pass this language in the Senate, but we've seen it. We discussed it. We didn't vote it up or down. We just didn't do anything.
And Madam Chair, in the bottom of page R15, we've got the trail provisions recommended by the department. The one difference you'll see on R16, on 35.26, you see the senator's name is the Becky Laurie Trail, and on the House on 16.26, the House has it the Minnesota-Wisconsin Boundary Trail. And Madam Chair, on the bottom of page R16, there is a little difference in the way this Willard Munger Trail system works. The House actually fixed a problem from a few years ago, as I understand it, there was a gap in the trail. And so what the House did is made sure that they kind of filled in that gap, as I understand it. You can see that on 17.7 with the Hinckley and Pine County, so that it fixes that gap that was enacted a few years ago.
And what did we do in the Senate?
Well, Madam Chair, we took the department.
We didn't fix it?
We did not fix it in the Senate, Madam Chair. I heard about this real late in the process. And I'd heard they fixed it in the House, and so it was either off the floor or on the floor, and it was just not a lot of time to fix it. But the House did, as I understand it.
And then on R17, there's a House-only provision, and this was a DNR provision that would revenues generated from natural resources from state parks and rec areas and such would be deposited in the state parks working capital account rather than the general fund.
Excuse me. Mr.
Mueller. Madam Chair and members, when the Senate bill originally had this in it, and then when we went through the Finance Committee, when the head fiscal analyst was taking a close look through the bill, determined that this actually would cost the general fund less than $10,000 a year in lost revenue. It's on average. There is a little bit of revenue that goes in that would be diverted out of the general fund and into the working capital fund on average each year that the DNR, so we'll have to maybe get a clarification from the DNR on this one.
And Madam Chair, on R17, what you see on the Senate side, Section 1, is actually from Senator Erickson Rope's bill that passed the Senate that deals with the same issue of free entrance for the disabled veterans. The one difference is if you just look on the House 18.5, you see it's a daily park permit, and that the Senate just deals with a permit, so it could be the annual permit. Otherwise, they're the same, I think. And then on the bottom page, R17, 21 and 32 were department recommended language that carried forward. Same with on the top of page R18, the state water trails. Now, there are some differences in section 23 on the Senate and section 34 in the House. Both sides allow for for the school-sanctioned activities and youth activities to be exempt from the ski pass. Two things, the Senate on 37.16 to 37.18 said that the organizer has to notify the agency with jurisdiction over the trail before doing it, and the times and everything. And then on 37.19 to 37.27, the Senate's carrying language that allows a free ski pass for those people that were stationed outside the state and are on leave, and then also residents who are served the preceding 24 months in federal active service. This is patterned after what we have in the game and fish law for free fishing and small game and deer licenses. So what this would do would be allow them to ski while they're on leave or the first 24 months after they come back without a ski pass. And Madam Chair, the user fee, the increase is the same. Again, we'll see that on the spreadsheet. That's section 24 and 35. Section 25 on the Senate and 36 on the House, there are some differences. The Senate allows the use of the ski pass money on 38.18 for development and maintenance of state cross-country ski trails. On 19.3, the House says it's for administration of the cross-country ski trail grant program. They can use, this is a statutory appropriation for the money. And then in paragraph B, the House also says that development and maintenance of state trails are eligible for funding if the money is appropriated by law. So it would require a direct appropriation to fund the agency activities on their cross-country ski trails. The Senate just allows them to use the money in the statutory appropriation for that purpose. On the horse trail pass on the bottom page, R19, the only difference that I'm aware of in the horse trail pass language is on 20.9, where it says except forest roads. So you wouldn't need you wouldn't need a horse pass if you were on forest roads, but you would need one on any other lands administered by the Commissioner of Natural Resources. And Madam Chair, that takes us through R21, and 27 and 38 are the same on the House and Senate side. Section 6 and 39, this is again from Senator Cooley's bill. This is the watercraft provision. The provisions are the same in allowing the Indian tribal government to do this, but the one difference is on the Senate side. If you look in the effective date, what they need to do is they need to get approval from the United States Coast Guard before this can occur. The House says that it's effective upon written approval from the Coast Guard. The Senate is effective when the Commissioner publishes notice in the State Register that they've received approval. So it's a little bit different that the Senate requires a notice in the Public Register before this could take effect. And then the House has a House only on Section 40.
Section 40 was a House floor amendment. This would exempt rowing team members from wearing a personal flotation device.
And Madam Chair, now we're getting into the forestry provisions. And if you look at Section 28 on the Senate and Section 41 on the House, both sides have this provision that allows for kind of a permit by rule or whatever, or an open permit without getting the individual written permit, as long as the county and the commissioner agree. A couple of differences on 41.13 on the Senate, it says written or electronic permits under this subdivision. That was when Senator Fredrickson kind of brought up this point that the concern was that whether or not the locals could still issue individual permits in these areas if they wanted to. And so it was, we wanted to make it clear on the Senate side anyways that it would be only under the subdivision. It doesn't affect any of the other local authorities for requiring an individual electronic permit. And then if you look on the bottom of R23, paragraph E on the Senate and paragraph E on the House, what the Senate says is that the permit, this general burning permit, can only be canceled either by the commissioner or the county board. Both parties come to an agreement on this to begin with, and on the Senate side it could be canceled by either one. On the House side it says by mutual agreement of the commissioner and the county board, so it would require both parties to agree to cancel this general burning permit. And then Madam Chair, in the bottom page R23, the special permits language, as I understand it, that's the same. And that was, again, this is language brought to us by the agency. Section 30 and 43, as I understand it, are the same. And then we have some House-only language in Section 44.
Section 44 relates to a pilot project that was passed last session. It gets repealed later on, you'll see in the repealer. But this would just amend the commissioner's ability to lease state land to kind of allow for that pilot program. And it just lets the, increases the years from 10 to 50 so they could lease the land for timber production for a longer amount of time. And then it would also require them to have public access that was similar to that if it was still in state administration.
And Madam Chair, on page R25, sections 31 and 45 are the same. Sections 32 and 46 are different. The Senate on, if you look on page R26, the Senate on 43.17 just says we changed the number of employees that are eligible for these intermediate auction sales from 20 to 30, and the House changed it from 20 to 30, but also says that the 30 employees are working in the timber or wood products industry. So if they have other employees that if they're beyond 30 employees and the other employees are doing something else, then they will still be eligible for the intermediate auction sales. And then, Madam Chair, on paragraph C on the House and Senate, the House has some additional language dealing with the Department of Employment and Economic Development providing information to figure out if somebody, basically the number of employees, and then also a new sentence on 26.30 that a bidder is considered eligible and may participate in intermediate auctions until determined ineligible by this paragraph. And the House also has a retroactive effective date for this provision going back to July 1, 2006. And Madam Chair, the auction sale procedure on section 33 in the Senate, 47 in the House, if I understand it, is the same. And there's a section 48 on the House side from the game and fish laws.
And this is came in as an amendment, and it would provide an exception from the firearm safety training portion, the shooting and range exercise portion, and the classroom instruction portion for members who have gone through basic training and sniper training with the U.S. Armed Forces.
And Madam Chair, if you look on page R28, there's a Senate only on the petition of district court for a beaver dam. The Senate is carrying a provision that was recommended by the department. On basically what it does is it gets the department out of the, they've actually been out of the business of beaver dam control for almost 20 years. And what this does is basically aligns the section of law to coordinate with currently is done out in the world.
And section 49 is a provision from Representative Lanning's basin management bill that he's been carrying for the last couple of years, and this would establish a basin watershed management policy and statute. And then sections 35 and section 50 are the same, just a technical provision. Section 51 is a provision brought by the DNR that would allow for some expedited a process for making changes to wild and scenic river boundaries. And then section 52 just goes along with that. And sections 36 and 53 are the same. Moving on to R31, section 37 and 54 are the same, and so are all the other sections on that page. And then on the top of R32, this is another DNR provision related to groundwater appropriations. There's some minor differences here. The House has some additional language requiring that when making waivers or other decisions that the commissioner kind of have a sustainable water determination rather than just...
And Madam Chair, just for your convenience, if you look, this word, you really couldn't line this up because of the way it's structured, but if you look at 48.1 on the Senate to 48.2, and then if you look on the House side at 33.6 to 33.9, the waiver provision is actually in a different location in the House side, so you can compare. The Senate says we can waive those requirements for just cause, and the House has put additional restrictions on that in paragraph B. Why don't you continue?
Moving on on R33, sections 41 and 58 are the same as R42 and 59. And Section 44 and 61 also are the same. And then on the bottom, R34, there's a Senate-only provision.
Madam Chair, this is a provision carried in the Senate by Senator Rummel. And it deals with basically cutting the fee in half for aquatic management permits on any water bodies that are less than 20 acres in size, or 20 acres or less in size. Basically, the fee would be one half. And that the section is actually effective August 1st, if you look on the top of page R35. And then, Madam Chair, both sides have the sunken log provision, and as I understand it, that's the same. And then the House only on Section 33, Section 63 on page R35.
Right, and this is a provision related to the SSTS ordinance delay that's you'll see later on. This would require the establishment of an implementation and enforcement task force that would advise the PCA and their rules and with enforcement and going forward.
And Madam Chair, on the bottom of page R35, you'll see a provision that Senator Dibble carried, and actually it's enacted into law. You can see it's a Section 47 enacted into law, so we won't need to carry Section 47. That's already done on the hierarchy for the waste material.
It's already gone where? It's already been signed?
Yes.
Okay, it's a law.
Madam Chair, that's what the reference is. It's Laws Chapter 2010, excuse me, Laws 2010, Chapter 272.
And on the top of R37, you'll see another provision from Representative Portman's bill. This would establish the PCA's requirement for environmental, or goal to have 150-day environmental permitting.
And Madam Chair, this next section, it didn't come out very well in the revisor side-by-side. If I can get somebody to hand this out, apparently the... if you look on page R38, you'll see the House is on one side, but the Senate's language is on R39. So what I did is I did the old-fashioned way, cut and paste. Haven't done that for 20 years, but to line them up a little better so we could actually see the language across from each other. So you'll see another provision, because basically if you look on R38, on 37.17 to 38.12 lines up with on R39 on the Senate 53.4 to 53.26. The Senate we chose to basically redo this a little bit to make it clearer and put in paragraph coding and all of that, which caused problems for the revisor in comparing these two provisions. So what I did is put together just a sheet that will show basically where the differences are. The differences are not great. It's really most of it's stylistic. There's one provision, though, that I think we need to highlight that is different. And if you look on the handout I have for the new page, R38 and 39, that I cut and pasted, you can see on 53.5 on the Senate side, the existing law says prohibits solid waste disposal. That was changed to determine site suitability. You will not see that on the House side. But basically,
say those numbers again, please.
53.5 on the Senate side, and you'll see on the House side that lines up with it's a current law. They use the term prohibit solid waste disposal on 37.16. So that's one difference on the Senate side. And then what you'll see is also some provisions dealing with financial assurance are in different locations, but we say exactly the same thing on 53.13 on the modification for financial assurance rules. And then on the House side, it's on 37.34. So again, it's a slightly different location. The Senate also, again, did this a little bit stylistically, a little different, and put them into clauses on 53.19 to 53.22 and 53.26, whereas the House has that embedded in 37.25 to 37.34. And so, but they're identical as far as the language and what they do. It's just that they're different styles. And then if you look also on page the R39 that I handed out, if you look at the top, you can see, again, the current law said prohibit areas from solid waste disposal, and the Senate has changed that to determine site suitability for solid waste disposal. So that's really the difference between the two. The rest of it's all stylistic changes. And Madam Chair, then we can go back to the regular side-by-side on page R39. And R-40, those are all identical. R-41 is the same. R-42, except for the very bottom where the house only provision is the same, and then the house has a provision, section 67.
And this is another provision from Representative Portman's bill, and you'll see the change on line 41.34. Instead of a 30-day period, it's a 30 business day period. And then you also see on R-45 that there's a requirement on lines 43.14 through 43.16 that would require responsible government units when doing environmental review to coordinate with any federal environmental review requirements. And then section 68 is a house-only provision requiring the development of customized environmental assessment worksheet forms, and also the submission of electronic EAWs and permits. And on R-46, section 50 and 69 are the same as our sections 51 and 70. And then on the bottom of R-47, there's a Senate-only provision.
And I'm not sure. I think Mr. Mueller should explain section 52 on the Senate side. I think, Madam Chair, it has to do with the earlier passed appropriations bill. There was a technical change that was needed, and Mr. Mueller, I think, can explain it better.
Madam Chair and members, this is a change in the first budget bill that we passed this year, the first cut at balancing the budget, and it's just correcting a reference to one of the cancellations that we made with a DNR appropriation that they had from a previous flood cost share appropriation. So it's just correcting a reference.
And then on the bottom of page R-48, there's a school trust land study, and this would require the DNR to provide the legislature with some information on how they're managing school trust lands. There's another requirement in section 73 that would require the DNR to provide a mechanism for school trust lands to be compensated when the lands are being used for outdoor recreation purposes. Then section 74 would establish the Coon Rapids Dam Commission. You see that in R-49 through R-50. And then sections 53 and 76, this is the SSTS ordinance adoption delay, and we the Senate has a delay of 2 years from the adoption of the rules, whereas the House has 10 months from the adoption of the final rule amendments that they're making. And then there's some additional.
Yeah, Madam Chair, with the Senate, it would have been, they were supposed to have it by February 4th, 2010. The Senate gives them an additional 2 years, and then beyond that time. And then there's a paragraph B that asks for a report from the agency after consulting with Bowser and the AMC, reporting to the chairs and ranking minority members of the technical changes that were adopted on February, technical changes to the rules that were adopted on February 4th, the progress in local adoption of ordinances, and the progress in protecting the state's water resources from pollution due to subsurface sewage treatment systems. Madam Chair, the next one on R-50 and 51, we have the long-range budget analysis. As I understand it, the only difference between the two is the Senate has an October 15th date and the House has a November 15th date. And Madam Chair, though, on further reflection on both of the dates on these, it might be better, because the legislature will be getting organized in November of next year, to maybe delay it a little bit longer than that. I don't know what your preference is, because the chairs may not change, but they may. And especially the October 15th on the Senate side, I don't think would work very well, because that's before the election and before any organization would occur. So, Madam Chair, on page R, bottom page R-51, this is the mechanisms input report, and that is the same on both sides. And the Senate has a Senate-only provision on page R-52 on wind energy systems on state-owned lands. That's a report asked of the Commissioner of Natural Resources to report on the use of state-owned lands and concerns and types of lands that should or shouldn't be used for wind energy systems. And we're asking them to bring a report back next February on that. And then, Madam Chair, on on R-53. We'll get to this a little bit more in the spreadsheet, but the Senate has a one-time appropriation for the peace officer training account, and the House has an ongoing one. The language is a little bit different on both sides, but that's basically the difference. And then, Madam Chair, on this Section 58 on the Senate side, it's the state water trails. The House has the same $60,000 for that. The Senate also has in Section 59 appropriation for the Moose Trail. That was done a few years ago. I think it was 2008, and that appropriation expired, so the Senate is carrying an appropriation, then also making it available until spent. Apparently, they weren't able to get the trail in time. And then, Madam Chair, again, this will be on the spreadsheet, but both sides have the ecological classification program, just a little different style. And the Senate also in Section 61 has Parks and Trails appropriations to the Met Council and the DNR from the lottery and lieu account. And Mr. Mueller can go over that with a spreadsheet. And then on the top page, 54, some House only.
Section 77 is the moratorium on the hazardous waste incineration facility permit that the PCA is currently.
Ms. Taylor, sorry.
Sorry.
It's hard to hear everybody, but we're just, could you speak up, please?
Sure. On the top of page R-54, section 77, this is the hazardous waste incineration facility moratorium mentioned in the governor's letter, the 3M facility. Section 78, this would allow for a pilot project on the Cannon River to allow canoe and inner tube rental establishments to provide one bay per group rather than one bay per person as the current rules allow for. And then section 62 and section 80, the revisor's instructions, the only, there's one technical difference, and then the term for to replace canoe and boating routes, the Senate has state water trails, whereas the House has water trail routes. In section 63 and section 81, this is the repealer, and we talked a little bit about this earlier. The differences are, the Senate has the repeal of the native prairie definitions, and then if Senate, like the 97B.
Yeah, Madam Chair and members, just one thing on the water trail routes. The term that was used in both sides, though, in the statutory section is state water trail, so that was why it was changed on the House side. The DNR language came in water trail routes. I just want to explain why it's different on the Senate. As discussed, but the House also includes the Minnesota rules on the Minnesota Conservation Corps. Yes, the Senate on the repealer 97B.665 subdivision 1, that's the beaver issue with the beaver dams, with the control. The Senate, it goes along with the changes that were made that were earlier described. And then, of course, the Senate does have the repeal of the definitions for that. And then, but you'll see, this is where it lines up a little better. You'll see the Senate and the House both repeal the definitions from last year and the 3.3006, which is cross-reference to those definitions. And then on page R-55, the Senate it also repeals the legislative guide on 63.22. And then Article 4, reorganization, this was Senator Mary Olson's provision. And this does provide for the Environment Natural Resources Organization Advisory Committee, and this was again worked on by Senator Mary Olson, is included here. It's an 18-member group, and they can set up, they also set up three task forces, intergovernmental task force, an employee participation task force, and a stakeholder task force. I don't think I'll go over the language in any detail now because the House doesn't have any language on this, but that's basically what it is, and it's they're going to provide reports back and consider certain agencies for organizational structure. And that goes all the way through R-59. There's an appropriation of $30,000 from the Environmental Fund to the Commissioner of Management and Budget for the expenses of operating. It's the expenses of paying per diem for the 18 members and their expenses. And then on, before, you have Article 6 in here, and we did skip one article. There's not an Article 5, which in the Senate side is the state lands. Provisions is Article 5. The House has not passed the lands bill yet, so I don't have them in a side-by-side like this yet because it would just show nothing on the House side. I do have a draft of a side-by-side comparison with the House as it's sitting on the floor if we wanted to go over that at some point, but we can bring that to you at another time if you want, since it hasn't it would just show nothing on the House side, so we didn't do it yet. But I do have a draft that has, that shows all the comparisons. But I just, before you move on to energy, I just wanted to point that out, that that's a missing piece right now.
We'll come back to that later.
I'm ready for energy.
Madam Chair, I think we passed on that.
Madam Chair, starting with Article 6, the energy article, the first provision on the Senate side was added on the floor. This, I believe, is language that was suggested by the Department of Commerce, and this would change the apportioning for the assessments to operate the Legislative Energy Commission. The next section is, on both sides, is for solar photovoltaic module rebate program, and both the Senate and the House codified the program. There's just one slight difference that we called it a program just in the title of the statute. I think there are a few differences on the House side that I'll have them go through in some of the definitions that we didn't. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. So on the House side, I believe for manufactured, the looks like they separated out the definition into two paragraphs. I'm not sure that the intent is that much different, and I'm not sure if this was who suggested this language or why it was changed. So, and then also for qualified owner, it looks like they separated it out into qualified owner and qualified property, and it kind of takes some of the language from the Senate side and puts it into qualified property for residents, multifamily residents.
Ms. Fontaine?
Yes.
I'm going to just jump in and say for the House, I don't know if anyone on the House side is a member of the Energy Committee.
I was in 89.
Just for information, this passed. This is in my omnibus bill in the Senate. Obviously, I've got environment and energy finance, so this is Representative Rukavina's bill in the House that passed separately, but it's matching up. This was incorporated in my omnibus bill as Senator Tomasoni's bill. So just wanted to point that out. So the language here is Representative Rukavina's in the House position.
And Senator Murphy, I sit next to Bill Hilty, so I can ask him questions.
Very good. We'll use your osmosis power to figure out what to do with the two of you.
Okay, continuing on then at lines 103.18 and 3.11 on the House side, the systems are at 100 kilowatts on the Senate side, not to exceed 40 kilowatts on the House side. On page R3, there are also some differences. Looks like some technical differences in the use of hyphens on end use, off-site, and that. Then down on subdivision 4 on both sides, in the Senate side, we included language that says an amount not to, this is on line 104.3, and an amount not to exceed $5 per kilowatt of installed generating capacity. And at the, on the House side, it's just, it's at $5 per kilowatt. There are some other slight differences in language in the paragraph B on 104.5 and 3.33. Those are just wording differences. And then on the Senate side, we did change the appropriations. We put those in statute instead of leaving them in a separate appropriation section, so that's what you'll see in subdivision 5 on the Senate side. And I believe that those are the differences for that particular program. And then on R4, we have, this is a Senator Dibble provision on the Senate side, and I can't remember who it was on the House side, but I just wanted to mention that we did adopt this yesterday in economic development. And that is, so we're putting together a report, just to FYI, that we may not need it in this spot, but I guess it doesn't hurt at this point. And I believe that's the same language. On R5, on the Senate side, this is, it would provide an additional $800,000 to the Public Utilities Commission for some supplemental staffing. This was Senator Pretner Solon's bill. And the...
And I believe Representative Hilty has the same bill?
Yes, Representative Hilty does. It's on second reading.
Okay.
On the House side.
Is that what you were going to say, Mr. Soderman? Thank you.
On Section 5, on R5, this is purely a technical change just in the wording on 106.2 to make sure it's reappropriated to the Commissioner of Commerce. That was left out before. On page R6, it looks like I know that there are a couple of bills that are the same in the House and Senate, but this neighborhood energy planning and implementation process in Section 6 is $80,000 to CERTS to organize a community planning process for this, a proposed high voltage transmission line. And then on the House side, there's an urban transmission line certificate of need required. And I know in the Senate that we have, it looks like this is in conference committee actually on both sides. It's, yeah, Ron?
Yeah.
Mr. Soderberg?
Madam Chair, members, yes, this is a conference committee. I think it's a Berglund bill on the Senate side.
Right.
And the House side, it's Representative Clark. And I think the difference is the Senate has $80,000 for the study. The House has $100,000 for the study. And then there's some differences in how the study would be performed. And I think the other difference is that the House has the appropriation for the certificate of need or the authorization for the certificate of need. And I don't believe the Senate does, but I think that was going to be picked up at conference.
And then the language on the certificate of need requirement, that was the policy piece. Is that in here, too?
Madam Chair, it's not on the Senate side, but...
No.
Oh, I thought we were going to put the whole thing in here. Are there differences between the House and Senate on the language and the policy? On the certificate of need requirement. I know Senator Berglund had asked me if we could just deal with the whole thing in this conference committee. That was her preference. So I guess we'll have to follow up on that and see.
I don't recall that there's any, I don't think it'd be a significant difference.
Very close.
It may be in timing at most, because with the report, some of the timing issues, but that they're worried about the timing issues because it requires the report to be done before the certificate of need starts.
Madam Chair, it was just suggested that maybe I could have the revisor or grab a side-by-side. If they're in conference, they probably already have one and could see what the differences are.
That would be great.
Okay, so I think that can concludes the energy article.
Great. Well, why don't we do the spreadsheet?
Madam Chair, before you do the spreadsheet, I can hand out the repealer language from Eric Blunt so people can take a look at it.
Sure.
I'll wait till that comes around.
Great.
What the House is repealing is at the bottom, Section 9, the 25-year guide. Our 25-year strategic plan, sorry.
So you repeal our plan and we repeal your plan, the legislative plans? Is that sort of the gist of it?
Madam Chair. It seems to be the size of it.
Thank you. All righty. Great. And are there any questions on anything we've gone through? I mean, anytime, raise your hand. All right. Let's go through the spreadsheet then, please.
Madam Chair, that should have been passed out already. It's a four-page or two-page double-sided spreadsheet that covers all the different articles. The Article 1 is Outdoor Heritage Fund. There's at least on the appropriation the numbers part of it, they're exactly the same. The differences are only in the language within the appropriations that we just went through and it went through the side-by-side language, but as far as totals go and amounts, they're exactly the same between the House and the Senate for the Outdoor Heritage Fund, which is a total of $58.9 million in fiscal year 11. So on to Article 2, which is the Clean Water Fund, on page 2. A few differences here. The House adds $300,000 to the coal tar best management practices and for grants. Both sides sort of, that 145 there in brackets is just stating that both sides allow up to $145,000 of it to be used for the PA, the polysilic hydrocarbons. And both sides have that. The Senate just has it taken out of the current appropriation. The House adds 300 to it, and then also allows the 145 to be used for that purpose. The rulemaking for nitrate and nitrogen to the PCA, the Senate has 615,000, the House has 310. The next one, the House adds $200,000 to the existing appropriation for the St. Louis River and Duluth Harbor cleanup. And then both sides takes the $5 million appropriation that we made last year that was sort of a set aside for groundwater purposes that we gave to PCA. Both sides does it in a different way, but removes that from the PCA and then reappropriates it over on the, you'll see down on the next line, to the Department of Natural Resources for their groundwater monitoring. And within that appropriation language, there's a few differences. Senate makes it clear that this is a one-time appropriation and it's available till spent. The next one, the Senate has $500,000 to Met Council for continuation of their clean water planning. Last year we gave them $5,000 in fiscal year 10 and zero for fiscal year 11. The Senate continues that program. The House has zero for that. The next item, or the next agency for clean water is Board of Water and Soil Resources. The Senate has one provision for that. It's the Star Lakes, $100,000, the Star Lakes provision. It's the Senator Mary Olson provision, $100,000 each year. The House had some language in their bill addressing that. And then the House has three additional appropriations. To Bowser for these are just add-ons to existing appropriations that we made last year. $558,000 for riparian buffer easements, $557,000 for watershed district grants, and then $500,000 of additional money for wellhead protection easements. So in total, the Senate appropriates $1.315 million of additional clean water money. And this brings the fund balance down in fiscal year 11 to 5% of the expected revenue that's coming in fiscal year 11. And the House appropriates an additional $2.425 million. So this brings the fund balance down to about 3.5% on the House side. Last year we had sort of set aside a 10% of expected revenue. That dropped down to a little bit under 7% based on the forecast and just the downflow in the revenue.
Is that percent again?
The House the Senate brings it down to 5%, and the House brings it down to about 3.6%, I think.
Representative Wagenius.
I think it would be helpful for us at a later time to hear from Mr. Blankets that he did a probability analysis using normal sales tax revenues and how they fluctuate from the number that we came up with, and I think that might be helpful for the
sure.
To
hear that too. Sure. Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, and my comment follows up on that I think Mr. Soderbergh had some, after the February forecast, had some summaries on the funds of what money was available there, and then with the carry forward from the percentages that we had held back last year. So really we've provided expenditures for arts and history and for parks and trails, but there was some money held back from clean water And then the only fund that has the annual appropriations is the Outdoor Heritage Fund. So maybe if we at some point get those numbers, and maybe if there's anything new from Minnesota Management and Budget related to our current fiscal status and what that means for our revenues coming in, I think it'd be helpful as we make those decisions.
Sure. I think that those are both good suggestions. I mean, basically, we were being guided by current forecast information and wanted to maintain a 5% reserve, and it would be a rolling reserve so that it would, you know, every year would be replenished or spent, but end up at 5% is where we're at now. And based, you know, last year that we said 10%. So that's what we can talk about. If there's actually more possible, we're open to hearing about it, but I don't, yeah.
Madam Chair and members, so that's it for the clean water article on the Senate side and on the House side. The next is in the tracking, I combine articles, the Senate articles 3 and 4 together in one area. And first we have the Department of Natural Resources. The first item is the utility crossing fee waiver. This is where we change the fee that would be paid, and this would on the Senate side, this would result in a loss of revenue and thus a loss of expenditures within the DNR of $122,000. On the House side, I'm showing 12 right now, but I think in talking to Mr. Reinholz, this was actually only about 3,000. So they tried adjusting their fees, so it was pretty much even of both the amount of fees that they were losing that they'd gained and the amount that they'd raised in the other one. So that probably isn't 12. I think it's actually 3. Or pretty much 0. To appropriate the court surcharge, again, the Senate just, this was a governor's offshoot of a governor's proposal and a governor's bill. The Senate just appropriates it one time, $145,000, and then the House does it as an ongoing appropriation. Both sides have the $60,000 to pay for the extra canoe route. The Senate has $100,000, again, when we're going through the side-by-side, it's sort of a reappropriation for the out of the ATV account for the Moose Trail. The both sides have $250,000 out of the Game and Fish Heritage Enhancement Account. This was in the governor's proposal. It's a one-time appropriation of $250,000 for the ecological classification system. And then the Senate has two appropriations, one for $300,000, and this is ongoing for the state parks and trails out of the lottery and lieu account. And then, again, $300,000 for metropolitan parks and trails out of the lottery and lieu account. And going from the February forecast, there is money in those lottery and in lieu accounts to sustain this increase in appropriation, mostly because the lottery sales are coming in a little bit higher than back in November forecast. The next item is $30,000 on the Senate side to Minnesota Management and Budget to pay. It's a $30,000 appropriation.
Can I have your attention, please?
Out of the environment.
The castle is now closed to public tours.
Goodbye.
You can all go home now. Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Senator
Fredrickson?
Madam Chair, I was just thinking about the announcement. We're meeting. It should not be closed. The Capitol should not be closed to the public because the public's welcome to our
tours. This is a public meeting.
It said tours.
He did say tours, but I was wondering what
the difference really is. I think the public, yeah, this isn't the time that they normally close it to the public anyway, so I think people are safe. The public can stay.
Madam Chair, again, there's a $30,000 one-time appropriation on the Senate side. This would pay for the reorganization and just for the cost of the public, the per diem cost for the public members, but this does not cover any of the cost for any of the agencies for participating in the reorganization study. The next item is a House item, and I'll maybe...
Madam Chair and members, if you look at the bottom of page 2, you'll see the legislative auditor. You asked about this earlier, Madam Chair. The audit cost showing here would show a two-year cycle is being proposed. Two funds would be audited each year. These are just the financial audit costs. They do not include the restoration audit cost, I would make mention that the language on the house side for the restoration audit cost is it cannot exceed 0.25 of 1%. So it couldn't exceed 0.25% of each fund's biennial receipts. And so I'm just trying to do some math in my head. I believe that is what? $2,500 per million. And it's very difficult at this point to know how much it would be because it's both at the discretion of the Legislative Audit Commission, but there is a limitation on how high it could go. So if you had $100 million a year, you'd be looking at $250,000 would be the highest it would go. So that'll give you an idea of what the kinds of money you'd be talking about. But again, it's discretionary, and we would be looking at several years out because just to get these audit or just to get the restorations done, I know, are a multi-year project in and of itself. So that'll give you an idea. But these are the financial numbers for the financial portion of the audits.
Madam Chair, on this provision, we did have a bill that we saw in our funding division that looked at this, and we've been in discussion with the legislative auditor about different ways of maybe doing this or structuring it. And
on that point, I guess I'll just add, the way we left that conversation was that the legislative auditor believed they had the ability to pay for the audits, any audits that they would do in the rest for the rest of this, I guess, the biennium for next year. And so we decided just to leave it out and look at it as something we'd have to deal with in the next funding cycle for any of the funds to figure out, to put that in the upfront budgeting process. That was kind of how we left it in our division.
Madam,
for the legislative auditor audits, the ones that are already required by current law.
Madam Chair, on the next, we go on to page 3, which is, the first part is a summary of all fund expenditures. Just within Article 3 and 4, the Senate spends about just over $1 million. Most of this is for the state parks and trails and metro parks and trails, out of the natural resources fund, out of the lottery in lieu. And then the Senate and Hollis both have expenditures from the game and fish fund that are the same. There's a difference between those utility crossing fees. And then the House shows their audit costs there for the different dedicated funds. So the House has about $569,000 in new expenditures. And some of those are ongoing.
I should just point out, for Senator Chaudhry, we had, there'd been some discussion about whether the Game and Fish bill would be included in this conference committee. Obviously it's not. That's a separate bill, separate conference committee. But there is some spending from the Game and Fish Fund in that on the Senate bill. I don't know about the House bill. And so it'd be nice if when that conference committee is reconciled, we can add up all the numbers in one place for the Game and Fish Fund to make sure we're keeping track of it.
Madam Chair, then on to Article 5. This is the energy article. Well, it's Article 6, actually, I guess, on the Senate side. The cost for doing the solar projects out of the RDF fund are the same, $2 million in 11, then $4 million in 12, and $5 million in fiscal year 13. That's the same in both the House and the Senate. As mentioned before, the study to Twin Cities, the CERT's comprehensive plan, small difference. The House has $100,000, the Senate $80,000. And then on the certificate of need assessment, the House has it's a sort of assessment that gets split off into two different agencies. The 273 to Commerce, and then 34,000 goes to Public Utilities Commission. And then on the Public Utilities assessment, showing $800,000 on both sides. I guess it's not technically until the House passes their bill yet, but the House does have the same language in the bill that's on second reading. $800,000. That's an additional assessment for additional staffing. So then at the bottom, we have the bill total appropriations for all the different articles and funds. This includes the outdoor heritage, clean water, and then all the funds covered in the sort of the energy article and the other article. So the Senate has $5.2 million of additional spending, and the House has 6.1. Yeah, it does not include the outdoor heritage money. Doesn't include that. Yeah, so it's probably actually about $64 million on the Senate side when you include outdoor heritage and $65 million on the House side. Difference of about $877,000. The last item, revenues on the last page 4. Again, we show the different revenue losses on the Senate side for the utility crossing fee waiver of $122,000. In the House, again, I'm showing this at 12, but it's probably maybe a little less than that. The cross-country ski pass increase, both sides are at $71,000. The reoffering the unsold timber, this was a DNR provision, allows them to reoffer some unsold timber. It brings in some extra revenue into some of their dedicated accounts. That's the same on both sides. The aquatic vegetation fee reduction, the Senate Rummel bill, it's a small loss of revenue in fiscal year 11 and 12 to the water rec account. Then after that, the DNR would adjust the fees to make it revenue neutral. I've shown some revenues here on the Senate side for the lands bill. Again, those are just sort of dedicated revenues that come in typically in lands bill. And then the tribal government license exemption that's on the House and Senate side in the Senator Kubley bill. Commerce, we're showing the assessment cost for the certificate of need. That's an assessment there. And then the public utilities assessment, that would be on both sides. So there's $3.6 million of additional revenue on the Senate side and about $2.4 on the House side. That is it for the spreadsheet.
Questions? Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, I had a question about something that isn't in here. I'm aware there's been some flood damage money been moving through the legislature in both houses, and traditionally we've had some Bowser money provided to flooding. And is that, I don't know if that's passed the Senate, or is that going to appear to come out of or come into this budget?
That's a good question. I don't know where that ended. It did pass the Senate as a separate bill. And it was sort of a fast-track bill that never went through our division. You know something about it? It's general fund?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, as I recall the bill,
it's
general fund money.
It is.
I don't recall the exact amount. It's a few million.
It was three point something million, I believe, and it came from the tax committee. And where they magically make money, and I'm not sure to whom it was appropriated. I can't remember, so we could probably find that out. But the Senate, does the House have anything similar? It was the matching money that apparently that was needed for some federal funds.
Madam Chair, I just was just wondering, because we had cut a lot of flood money that we had appropriated previously, I think millions of dollars that we had. So I just was wondering if it was going to be another cut or something that was coming out of this budget.
No. It was bottom line money that was made available on a very quick basis to provide a federal match that was needed.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, as I recall, it was two specific counties that experienced flood losses, and I think were listed in a federal designation.
All right. We had proposed or let people know we were going to try to take testimony on various issues today, and I think we should start with the 3M incinerator issue, because we have the mayor of Cottage Grove who came down for a short time to be able to speak to us today. But maybe we should start with the PCA and have them testify about this issue. And I know it's in the governor's letter, so we can cover that ground at the same time and any other issues they have in the bill. And then we'll take any brief comments from other interested parties on this issue.
The machine.
So we'll start with that, and then we'll just go get us. There's a lot of people here who we'd like to hear from when we have a chance. So we'll get as far as we can. And if anybody is here from out of town and will find it difficult to stay or to come back, please let my staff know, the two people walking around, and we'll try to accommodate you. Senator Frederickson, besides you, I know you're here from out of town. Senator Frederickson, I'm very sorry, but, you know, it's only another few weeks for you to do this, right? We hope not. Yeah. All right.
We have other designs for him.
That's right, yeah. Well, I keep suggesting them, and he keeps saying he's going fishing, so he's busy. And he has grandchildren's soccer games to go to, so I think he has some plans. All right, welcome to the conference committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jody Boyne. I'm the Public Affairs Director for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. We'll start with the hazardous waste incinerator moratorium issue. And then if you have other questions related to the PCA from the governor's letter, I'd be happy to answer those as well. What I'd like to start with a little bit is some background on our work on this permit, and then talk a little bit about some of the concerns we have with the legislation as written. We believe at the PCA that there has been significant and sufficient public participation process in the development of this permit. The community, the company, and the MPCA have been working on this permit for almost 2 years. This includes the creation of a community task force that the community created, and more than 7 to 8 meetings among the parties. And modifications to the permit have been made. This permit has yet to go out on public notice. I think it's important to make a correction of a statement that was made on the House floor. Representative McNamara said that the PCA would be issuing this permit in June, and that's not accurate. This permit has not gone out on public notice yet. The permit is ready to go out on public notice. The hazardous waste incinerator in Cottage Grove had a permit, and now they're doing an expansion. And with the expansion, they will not be exceeding any of the thresholds. So at the PCA, we base our decisions on the laws that are set here and at the federal government, rules and standards. The expansion permit does not exceed or violate any of those standards based on our information, our data, our engineering, and our science. The permit would be ready to go out on public notice in June. And the PCA, it'll go on a dual track with another permit that they have. And that'll be a 45-day public comment period, and there will be at least one public meeting on that. So we're looking at about 45 days, so you're getting into mid to late summer. Then the information that's gathered during that public comment period will come back to the PCA for the staff to review. The staff will take time to review that information and then develop its recommendation to the Citizens Board. And I don't know if you're all familiar, but the MPCA has a Citizens Board that makes decisions to whether agree with or deny the staff recommendation. The Citizens Board meeting would be dependent upon the amount of public comments that are received during the public comment period, but we would be looking at fall. So I just wanted to correct that statement. It was said the PCA was issuing a permit, and that's not true. So we have had worked with the community on their concerns with the company. We have a public comment period that we have even yet to go through. We haven't even started that process yet. Delaying this permit through March or for a year, we're not sure what significant information it would provide to the process. We believe that we've already gone beyond, I think, what we consider our standard operating procedure in developing the permit application. We're not sure what the delay would bring. We believe as the proposed permit now stands, it meets state and federal regulations, and it protects human health and the environment. And that's what our job is. At the PCA, it's not about the 3M facility. It's about the permit and the standards that are in law and whether or not our permits meet those standards. And we apply the rigorous work to everyone. The language presents a little bit of a concern to us because it looks as if the legislative process might be being used to delay the permit, which is circumventing what we consider to be a very well-defined state and federal permit process. We are a bit concerned about precedent. We deal with a lot of, we're a regulatory agency, we permit facilities, we permit feedlots, we permit ethanol plants, we permit things that some people don't want, but it is our job, and we base our jobs on the rules and the standards. We have mining expansions coming into us in the fall. We have other, what some would deem controversial projects coming our way, and we're concerned that this could set a precedent where these delays could be put into statute saying we think we need more time. But from an agency perspective, based on rules, laws, and standards, we're not sure what that time would bring. We believe that we're not seeking legislative guidance in terms of the permitting process as it relates to this issue. And at this point, we don't support the language in the bill.
Ms. Taylor, can you point to the language again, where it is?
I'm sure it's R54.
Which article? Article 3?
Article 3, yes.
R54?
R54, Section 77 on the House side.
All right. I saw some hands. Representative Lavinia.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You appropriately said that this permit will meet human health standards that we currently have, and even with a new permit level. So my question is, the statutes require us to have air quality standards that meet a child's health. And I want to know if the pollutants that, and that's I think a 2001 law, and I want to know if the pollutants that are going to be emitted have been, the standards have been updated so that they're the child-based standards, or are they old standards that are based on what I call the 150-pound man standard, which is the kind of the old way that we did standards, and that would be my question.
That's fine.
Madam Chair, Representative Wiginius, it is my understanding that the permit as proposed was developed on existing rule law and standards. I would believe that would include the 2001 law. My permit staff is not with me today, but that is my understanding, and I'd be happy to confirm.
Representative Wiginius?
Yeah, if you would confirm it, each of those pollutants would need to be updated, yeah, and then they're updated in a cycle. I'm just hoping each one of them has been updated to meet the child-based standard, and it's not a standard previous to that. Does that make sense to you?
Yes. I will check in with Jeff Smith, our Industrial Division Director, and get back to the entire committee.
Thank you.
All right. Other questions? All right. Can you talk about if there's any other issues that the agency has or that the governor has related to your agency that we should be aware of?
The letter referenced some concern with the amendment that was added on by Representative Portman during the debate on Senate File 3275 in the House. And that amendment did two things, and it has an impact on other agencies besides the PCA. One of the ideas of the 150-day Golan report, I think coming from folks who are concerned in that area, is to see where these delays are happening in efficient permitting. So the idea of the 150-day goal for permitting would be once the agency receives a completed application, what we call the clock would start ticking, and we would accumulate data on how long it takes the agency to get that permit out the door. And as we accumulate that data, the legislation clearly specifies we need to answer questions in terms of, was it something we didn't get from the business community, did it not meet a standard, et cetera. I believe as the amendment is written, the clock would not start ticking for some that require environmental review until after the environmental review is completed. And that is a period of time I believe that if we're trying to analyze data and gather information about whether there are delays or perceived delays, being able to do those on a parallel track would be allowed for a better analysis of the data and to see where that's at. Thus, there is a last sentence of the amendment changed the public comment period for EAWs from 30 calendar days to 30 business days. And the concern with that is it adds time. Typically, we have 30-day comment periods. I just mentioned with the 3M hazardous waste facility, that's going to be a 45-day comment period. The PCA has extended comment periods. We often do a second 30-day comment period, depending on level of public comment and request. If a public comment period ends on a weekend or a holiday, we move it out to the next business day. So the concern with that is you could be adding anywhere between 10 days to 2 weeks for a public comment period.
Representative Wikinius.
Thank you. I understand your second point, but my first point, I'm missing something here. The statute, as it was amended by Representative Portman, doesn't slow down your processes. You still have the ability to speed up permit issuing as much as you can do. So I don't understand why, what the problem is here, I guess.
Madam Chair, Representative Wikinius, we understand that the permit process, nothing in that amendment changes how we do business.
That's right.
It is more or less how we collect data. And in some of our industries and in some of our permits, we do a better job at data collection in terms of what we do. How we're reading it is this: when the clock would start ticking, if it's a permit that does not require environmental review, the clock would start ticking when the permit application is received. If a permit comes in that has to meet project prerequisites as defined in statute, environmental review, the clock would start ticking after environmental review. And I believe when this idea of permitting streamlining came about, there's a large interest in people wanting to know what we hear at the agency, why it takes so long. Now, we have a different opinion on sometimes why things take long, but to be able to start documenting that and reporting that, even if something requires environmental review, being able to document that and report that within the 150 days would provide a better assessment.
Representative Wikinius.
I don't see anything in the language that would prevent you from analyzing this data any way, shape, or form. I mean, it's open. I mean, you can analyze it, and you can do it one way. This is just one way of doing it. You can do it three other ways or 20 other ways. There's nothing in the amendment that precludes you from doing that.
Is that a question or?
No, it's just a comment that I just thought we had a little miscommunication here.
Thank you. Representative Morgan?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Boyne, as I recall from the debate on the House floor when Representative Portman offered her amendment and somebody questioned her on it, if this is the amendment that applies in this case, correct me if I'm wrong, her answer had something to do with the fact that she had been working with stakeholders on some environmental review streamlining processes, and this was just addressing an area where the streamlining just wasn't going to work for all the stakeholders. But nevertheless, I think she referred specifically to 5/6 of the agreements were still going to be in place, and this was just one of those that was not going to be able to work out. Is that accurate from your understanding of this amendment?
Madam Chair, Representative Morgan, the PCA wasn't involved in all of the negotiations between those parties. We were, I think we were more of a technical, I mean, obviously we're the agency that people are interested in looking at. So from my perspective, there was agreement on a variety, a majority of those items. Yeah. I don't know whether or not this was one of them.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Boyne, and this gets at what I think Representative Wagenius was trying to mention at one point. The Hortman Amendment, does it go backwards from where current law is, or does it just reestablish a baseline to current law so that the streamlining would not apply to this particular case?
What doesn't even talk to
Ms. Boyne?
Madam Chair, Representative, it doesn't do anything to current law. It's a goal. It's a 150-day goal. In reading the legislation as it was written and then reading the legislation as it was amended, we had some internal debate at the end at the agency about whether or not it even concluded permit applications, because now as it's written, it is for projects that meet the prerequisites via statute, and those are typically projects that are environmental review related. We, of course, would read legislative intent to mean everything that comes into the agency that needs to be permitted needs to be documented, tracked, and reported on within 150 days. It was just, is there a break? Is there a break from when something is received that we wait for all the environmental review to be completed before we start tracking the days? For us, it's, the charge for the goal, I believe, is for the agency to report out what takes place within 150 days, and I think, as those close to this area know, environmental review sometimes does take more than 150 days. So we're just trying to, I think, do them on parallel tracks and say that maybe that environmental review project should start ticking at the same time. But it does not change statute or law. It is a goal.
Thank you. Other questions? All right.
In terms of there's just one word of caution that wasn't in the governor's letter, and it's more of an agency caution. When you're looking at the SSTS language, there's a difference. The Senate did a two-year extension from the February 2010 date. The House did a 10-month extension from the date that the new rules are adopted. The agency has concerns that the two-year extension to 2012 could put the counties in a little bit of a bind because the rules may not be done in a time that would allow them to implement, where the 10-month extension upon adoption would give the counties time to adopt. And then in the landfill siting, I was just reviewing the side-by-side today, and the House language is very prescriptive in terms of what it can do with prohibit. But I have some questions about when we're doing rulemaking for new landfill siting, if it's assumed that we can consider appropriate other factors in addition to the minimum time it takes of travel to the boundary for groundwater contaminants. When we develop our rules, there are other elements that are always taken into consideration, and so that's just something that I have a question about. I can check back in with my staff and come back when we're doing that section of the bill.
And just a question for the House, the landfill siting bill, is that traveling on its own also, or is it only in this omnibus bill?
Only in this omnibus bill.
So Senator Saltzman had passed it separately on the floor, but that's probably just an orphan. So we'll be discussing it here. Thank you. All right, we also need to hear from 3M, and I see a couple of legislators here that may, I don't know if Representative Bingham, do you want to say something? Senator
Stevens? Yeah, I was going to come up with the mayor.
Well, I thought we'd take 3M okay. First and then bring you guys up.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Doug Stang, 3M. Appreciate the opportunity to be before you today. 3M obviously wants to express our opposition to the House language in regards to our permit application related to our incinerator in Cottage Grove. 3M owns and operates the only hazardous waste incinerator in Minnesota. The permit that we are proposing, the scope is narrow. I'll try to be very brief in explaining what we're trying to do. Historically, 3M produced solvent at a level where we could basically use a portion of that solvent as a fuel source to operate the incinerator. As you know, they have to operate close to 2,000 degrees. So you need a great deal of fuel plus a supplement of solvent. Through a number of environmental initiatives in our company, we've significantly reduced our solvent production. As a result, that supplement of fuel, we now have to purchase more natural gas. So our proposal to the PCA was to allow us to modify our permit to take outside waste, but a very narrow scope to only replace what we used to historically produce ourselves to be used as a fuel source. That's the only purpose. It's not to take any other outside waste beyond that. We do not want to be a commercial incinerator. We can't be compensated for taking this waste. The only purpose is to be used as a fuel source. As natural gas prices have increased over the last several years, obviously those costs of the incinerator have also increased. The incinerator is not a revenue generator, so it's very difficult when those costs go up. There's not a lot of area where you can reduce. So the scope is very narrow. We're limited in the permit to what we can take in, how much we can take in. In addition to that, we recently just agreed to the city that we would reduce our input levels for heavy metals as well. So directly reducing that, one of the main concerns was the lead cadmium input that we put in, which ultimately impacts the emissions that come out. We voluntarily agreed to put those levels in our permit, which have not been in there before. So we have tried to be open, transparent through this whole process as PCA, so there's been a number of public opportunities. We've met with the city. We continue to address their issues and the concerns that we hear from the public. I want to conclude by saying our permit levels are up here, our emission levels are very low, and if anyone is interested, I can provide you that specific information. This industry is highly regulated. We have a very positive story to tell, and I think that's part of the reason why we're moving forward with the permit, and the PCA is willing to move forward as well with that. I want to mention one other component of it that would be impacted if this language was included. We did agree to PCA requested that we consider taking law enforcement waste as well. Law enforcement waste currently, if it's hazardous waste, has to be transported by the law enforcement agencies to Illinois. We said we would take that waste at no expense to the law enforcement agencies. So they now would be able to bring it to 3M, no cost. I have a letter of support from the Sheriff's Association, the Chiefs of Police Association as well, outlining the significant cost this creates for them that 3M would be taking place of. So we have the support. We think this actually, in terms of the environmental impact, is minimal. We're reusing something that would be burned anyway as a fuel source. We're saving natural resources, plus assisting our local agencies. So again, we would request that the House language not be adopted and that we be allowed to move forward with the permit process that we're currently in the middle of. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And so could I just clarify something?
Mr. Knapp.
Madam Chair, I just want to clarify a comment that was made. This would, during the moratorium, it says unless the hazardous waste accepted are small quantities of hazardous waste from a public body on an emergency basis at no cost to the public body. So I think the law enforcement waste would still be allowed under this.
Madam Chair, it's our interpretation would not, because our permit specifically limits us to only take 3M waste. Our current permit that we are operating under would not be modified. So it's a question as to whether that would be allowed. We would operate under the current permit that we are permitted under, so we wouldn't change that. So there's confusion as to whether that would allow us to do that. But we don't believe it would.
Madam Chair, I just want to get some clarity on this. So Madam Chair, basically what you're saying is that even though this says that it would allow it, what you're saying is you wouldn't change your permit to allow it. Your current permit doesn't authorize it, and so it would only be part of a new. You would have to get a new permit from the agency, kind of an interim permit from the agency to do this. But I just want to clarify that the language does allow that. The House language does allow that in the language. It's just a matter of whether or not they would get a new permit or not that would allow for this.
Mr. Stang?
Well, Madam Chair, I was going to say that's the issue, is that the permit that we're modifying would allow for it, but the existing permit, this would stop them from issuing any interim permit to allow for us to take that.
All right. Senator Saxhog.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the recent discussions, Mr. Stang, that you've been having with the City of Cottage Grove, say the last 30 days, could you share with us how that's been going, and are you close on the subjects that you have been dealing on?
Interesting.
Madam Chair, Senator Sarsal, we have been meeting regularly with the city or having conversations with the city on issues. As I mentioned, the heavy metals was one concession we made. Additional issue that we are discussing is air monitoring. The city would like us to consider air monitoring. We are open to that. We thought we had a process that we would be able to work through, but that has changed. The issue revolving around that is the cost of the air monitoring, the length of time. I'm not sure if we'll be able to work something out, but we are on the path to try to work out some agreement with the city on that. But 3M would voluntarily do the air monitoring and ultimately pay for it. Again, we don't know what the costs are, which is what's holding this up.
Representative Guineas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You said that the environmental impact would be minimal, and of course, what I am going to be asking you about is the impact on children. PCA wasn't sure whether the health standards that are being used are standards that predate our adoption of child-based standards, or are they standards that have been developed since we had child-based standards? I think we all understand that children take in more air per body weight than adults, and that's the issue. So do you know the answer to that question?
Madam Chair, Representative Vergenius, I don't, but I will, we will get that information for you.
So. Thank you.
Representative Hansen had his hand up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Stang, I haven't been too involved in this debate, but it seems to me we have a delay in the bill here until March 1st. And so you're operating under an existing permit right now, and we have essentially a 10-month delay. What would happen or would not happen relating to the company during that 10 months? I mean, where's either the harm or the remedy that's involved here for either 3M or the citizens? Because if the permit is not going to be issued for, the new permit's not going to be issued for 6 months, you know, I'm trying to get an idea of timing and what happens in between there. And I have to apologize, Madam Chair, but my voice disappeared a couple days ago and is not the greatest right now. But if that's what I'm looking for, is kind of the timing and what does or does not happen, or where's the harm and where's the remedy.
Mr. Stang.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, the increase in cost due to the change in solvent that we've been able to bring in internally is expected to be close to $2 million a year. We voluntarily suspended this permit last year to work through this process. So through that time, we've been absorbing those costs at the incinerator. As I said, it doesn't generate revenue. It's just an expense. The delay causes problems because the permit wouldn't be able to be issued till March. We're not sure what the time frame the PCA would begin the process. As PCA said, we're just starting the official process, and we're still not going to get the permit for several months. But every additional month, we have additional expenses. So we would look at all options to help make up those expenses. As I said, we've been absorbing it as long as we can, so now we're at the point where we'll have to make other decisions regarding that. So the delay is significant and would have impact.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is to Representative Wagenius. You talked about the 150-pound man standard and then child standards. I was 150 pounds in the second grade. So can you clarify, is there a 150-pound man standard, and who is that guy?
Representative Wagenius.
I love having Representative Davids in a committee with me. The old way of calculating human health was a standard based on somebody who would live only 72 years and would weigh 160 pounds. And so since I weigh less than 160 pounds, I just kind of call it the 160-pound man standard, but it is really a 160-pound standard.
Okay. But now, Madam Chair, now they've gone from that standard to a child standard.
Well, they're now, the statute we adopted in 2001 is a child-based standard, so you're looking at the impact of any pollutant on a child rather than on essentially on an adult. With the reasoning is that if the kids are going to be okay, we're going to be just fine.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Saxon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And on Representative Hansen, I think that the question you asked probably should be asked to the MPCA rather than 3M. The question here is a precedent of 10 months, and I think it's very serious. I mean, if there's a serious problem here, it needs to be done, but that's what I'm most worried about.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you
very much. Let's hear from some community representatives. All right.
Oh, sorry, Mr. Mayor.
You want to do here?
No, you can sit in the center. Thank you, members. This is Mayor Myron Bailey of Cottage Grove. Couple things. First, I appreciate you having the discussion on this, and
appreciate your time here today.
Please identify yourself for the record.
Oh, I'm Representative Carla Bailey.
Thank you.
District 57A. One of the ideas that we had here to do this provision was because the community is very concerned about the potential effects of this, of the accepting hazardous waste. But from a state policy, I think it's also to point out that, as former Representative Stang said, that it definitely is the only hazardous waste incinerator in the state. accepting hazardous waste from another source is a deviation from our policy here in the state. So I also want people to keep that in mind as well. But I will let Mayor Bailey speak to the relationship that has been occurring and the discussions that have been occurring between 3M and the community. And again, I just appreciate you allowing the discussion.
Okay. Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Myron Bailey. I'm the mayor of Cottage Grove, and I've been mayor just over a year and a half now, and on the council prior to that for 4 years. Just to share a little history on this particular situation that I think is important to understand. If you go back even before the incinerator issue, we have a PFC contamination issue in Cottage Grove that deals with our water situation. So we have a community, and frankly multiple communities in our area that are concerned about the overall environment, their health. So when 3M brought up this change in their incinerator permit process, obviously it was met with concern from the city of Cottage Grove and very much so the citizens of Cottage Grove. In the midst of all of this, we have met, as Mr. Stang has stated, with 3M numerous occasions through this process. Part of the, he mentioned earlier, we developed a community or advisory task force on the environment to try to see if we can work out some agreements and get a better understanding, because a lot of the information that we have is very technical in nature, and frankly, as mayor and council, we don't have that kind of technical background to deal with the different emission limits and so on. We had asked 3M early on to commit to us to not allow commercial incineration. They would not do that. And so the city of Cottage Grove passed a moratorium, in essence outlawing commercial incineration. So there was already some animosity there, if you want to say, between the company and the city of Cottage Grove based on that issue. In the midst of all of this, too, we have, you know, we hired a consultant to help us with our understanding of the environment in Cottage Grove. And we're at a point right now where we are negotiating with 3M on, as Mr. Stang stated, levels of specifically heavy metal and cadmium. We would like to see it as close, if not to zero, because we know what heavy metals does to children and frankly anybody in the environment. That's why the levels are deemed to be so hazardous at even small doses. And we're also talking to them about air emissions and having some type of air monitoring equipment placed in Cottage Grove. We haven't got to that agreement yet. And that agreement, as Mr. Stang stated, has to do with money. And we've met with the PCA, asked the PCA to help us with this. Unfortunately, they're not willing to help us with the air monitoring themselves. They stated that they would line us up with an outside firm of somebody to come in and do the air monitoring, but they didn't want to deal with this specifically with the city of Cottage Grove. They were concerned it would set a precedent. And so at this moment, we are waiting and still working through some agreements with 3M, and I can share with you that this provision in this bill has helped bring 3M and the City of Cottage Grove to the table to communicate and hopefully come to an agreement. We are not there yet. I think we're close, but as you heard from Mr. Stang, there's still some pieces that need to be put together, and I'm asking for your support and your help to work with us, the City of Cottage Grove and its citizens, on this specific issue so that we can hopefully come to some type of a resolution with the company of 3M. Myself as mayor and the council, I'll just share with you, we have no animosity towards 3M. 3M has been a great partner in our community for many years, put aside these issues of the PFCs and all that. And we want to continue to have 3M be a partner in the City of Cottage Grove. But I also have to answer, other than to the business in Cottage Grove, I have to answer to my citizens. And there's a citizens task force, or citizens group, a coalition that's been put together on this incinerator issue. We have a lot of concern out there, and I'm here to express that concern to you and ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor Bailey. Let me just ask you one question, I guess. We'll let Senator Stevens. You know what? Why don't we just finish the testimony, and then I'll save my question. Thank you. Senator Stevens.
Members, I know you've heard a lot about this issue, and I don't have very much to add except to say that because Representative Bigham was able to have this language inserted into the House, I'll just reiterate what Mayor Bailey said, that really did help bring 3M to the table to negotiate. I have distributed to the conferees an email that the city administrator of Cottage Grove, I don't know if I emailed it last night. I don't know if you have it in your packets. But
does anyone, maybe it's on our computers?
I saw it on the computer.
All right. All right. Well, we'll all go look for that, or we can get it printed out otherwise.
I know we were working on getting it. We should have brought it.
Mr. Cadalco was trying to make sure.
But okay. Essentially what it, the content of it is somewhat immaterial in that there is a list that the city had printed out and sent to interested parties stating the concessions or the points of agreement or what they thought the progress they were making on negotiating some sort of agreement. And then Mr. Stang from 3M replied to clarify some additional points he wanted to make to that list of provisions that had been circulated. So I guess I just point to that as an example of, because this language is still alive, the city is gaining more comfort and the community is gaining more comfort that this expansion of a hazardous waste facility, because again, members, this is the one hazardous waste incinerator in the state, and this will bring in hazardous waste from other states, from non-3M sources, into Minnesota. So as a community, although, you know, the PCA has said that they're still going to fall within their current air regulation standards, that doesn't necessarily bring comfort when, if you look at what the standards are, some of them for VOCs, for instance, their actual emissions are five times lower than their permanent emissions. So there still is significant room for those emissions to increase under the permit as it's as it currently stands and as it's been explained will likely be approved by the PCA. So again, I just ask you to keep this provision alive. We're open to working on compromise language, but we don't want to discard it now. Otherwise, the company may lose any incentive it has to continue to work with the city to reach some sort of agreement on the heavy metal emissions and the air monitoring most specifically.
So, Mayor or your legislators, I mean, is your intention with this language in here to stop this incinerator from expanding? Mayor? Bailey?
Yes. Speaker, or I guess it's Chair.
Chair.
Madam Chair. Wanted to, you don't want that position?
We don't have one in the
Senate.
Can't be.
There you go. You know, there are definitely people in our community that would want them not to expand at all. We understand that they need to do business. Our goal in this is to come to an agreement with 3M on the amount of product or the types of product that comes into our community, the air monitoring piece of it, so that we can let our citizens understand, you know, that their concerns are either valid or not valid from what's coming out of the stack, and specifically the heavy metal particulates that everybody's most concerned about. The problem that we're having right now, as it relates to what you're doing, is you're about to end this process, and we're still in negotiations with 3M, and I'm afraid that if this process doesn't go through, we're still in the negotiation phase with 3M. We may not have the opportunity to come to some agreement with them because I don't believe we're going to be able to get this done before you guys adjourn. And so that's where I'm at. I'm not saying that they outright need to stop. Our goal, obviously, is to limit the exposure to my community.
You know, it just makes me, this whole discussion is just making me think, you know, wouldn't it be nice if the permitting process would cause this to happen, would just require some kind of negotiations between the parties? And
very much so.
That would be a really beneficial process in all kinds of situations. And I mean, I know we have public notice and comment, and maybe that's intended to have that sort of impact, but it doesn't always get people, you know, at the table side by side talking with each other, so I think that's always productive to do that. So I'm glad that's what you're doing.
Yeah, Madam Chair, that is our goal, is to come to some agreement with 3M on this process.
All right. I saw Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I
the mayor addressed some of the concerns I would have if I was the mayor of Cottage Groves. Being a former mayor myself, you have about 8 days, and we've all seen in the governor's letter where this, if it's risen to the level where it's actually mentioned as a concern in the governor's letter, I don't like providing false hope, and I think this amendment maybe that was put on the floor of the House may be some false hope. But it passed the House floor.
Yeah, right.
You're correct. You're correct. You know, the permits are sufficient to deal with the expansion already, so I don't know how the MPCA could possibly say that they can't go ahead. And so I guess my only advice would be, if you're close to an agreement, get there really quick, because it's not looking good for your side, is what I'd say.
Okay, well,
I think that, in the end, they're trying to do things in the right way, Representative Davis, and I think that having the discussion and getting it done where both sides can agree is probably better than just doing something so that it's done. And I think that, that's the discussion that has to happen between 3M and how to score on a local level and the local government level, the negotiation structure on that.
And then thank you, Madam Chair, and Teresa Bingham. There's an amendment on the floor to remove the language.
Right.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Other questions? Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mayor, and colleagues. Has anybody asked 3M, when Senator Saxhog asked, where's the harm, where's the remedy for 3M or the community? And it seemed to me the answer was in terms of dollars and cents. Has anybody asked 3M what the cost is in terms of public goodwill? Because for me, the 3M brand is in the billions of dollars in terms of value, just as a brand. And 3M must spend, I wouldn't even begin to guess, on public relations and advertising, that if they could credit the air filter to their public relations department, you could solve the problem.
Very good.
So I think we have to. There are some costs that, and I don't know how many people in this room have. I do have shares in 3M, and I care about their brand. I care about the company. I think it's a wonderful company, but it disturbs me that there is this resistance to a community that is host to a facility that is causing them some concern. So I just suggest that you ask that question.
Sure. The only thing I would add, Madam Chair and Senator Rummel, is that adding the pollution to the community is no benefit to the community. So you are 100% right. There is no benefit to allowing 3M to pollute the community for the community. So that's
but there is there is a cost to 3M, I believe.
Yes.
That they're not talking about.
All right.
Good observation.
Any other questions? Thank you very much for the
thank you so much, members.
Thank you.
Participation and
thank you.
Excellent. That was. I mean, members, what I'd like to do is ask. We're going to ask our staff to help us identify which issues are in debate here that we need to take testimony on, and we don't have an awful lot of time today. But so I guess the question is. At some point, we're going to need to hear from all the hunting and fishing groups and grapple with those issues about the definitions and other related language. But I don't know if there's a list of people who would like to testify on that. We definitely would want to hear from some of them. We also need to hear from the other state agencies and the utilities on the utility crossing. I guess there's nobody necessarily who's here from out of town who won't be here for the rest of the conference committee. So members have any, I guess we'll go on with the state agencies unless members have a preference otherwise. Senator Chaudhry.
Just a process question. Mm-hmm. Is there a possibility of for planning purposes, some of these folks who want to testify to maybe designate a time, maybe especially on some of these larger issues that we know that we're going to get testimony on?
Well, it would be...
It doesn't matter when to me, just
sure.
Just
I understand, and it would be nice to be able to do that. We've had really been disadvantaged in terms of the schedule, just not even being able to start until now, and there is a deadline of for conference committees to complete by Sunday at midnight, tomorrow. Now, I don't know, I keep being told, the Senate keeps being told that that is a deadline that is agreed to by the House and Senate. And so, I guess, if we're going to finish by tomorrow night, well, either way, we have to decide on when we're going to meet. So maybe I should ask, we should ask Representative Murphy if you want to give us some guidance about whether, since she'll have the gavel for the next meeting, if it's tomorrow, or does it switch back every day, the gavel? So.
Madam Chair, in the House, Mother's Day is a national holiday.
Yeah, I've heard sort of different opinions about whether it would switch on a Sunday. If there's no meeting on Sunday, does it switch back to the Senate? I've heard different views on that, so we should probably get, I don't know if there's some official rule somewhere that will tell us. In any case, we need to decide when our next meeting is, and we can certainly try to set a time for that, but the way things go around here, times change because of factors beyond our control. So all I can say is we'll do our very best to have some certainty in the, as we move forward. Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, I suggest that we continue with your agenda and call the various agencies before us, and by the end of that, we may have more information.
All right. Yep, that sounds like a good plan. Representative Davids on that?
I'll pass. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Hansen.
Chair, I know that Mr. Jashke is here, and maybe if to go into a certain fund, if we could go into the Clean Water Fund and maybe have an update on, we're adding to, and I see that also there's the League of Cities here, we're adding, there's some proposals to add to like the coal tar grants and those type of things, and maybe that's an opportunity to talk about those items.
All right. Well, I think we will go to the state agencies next, and I don't know, I mean, I don't know what the League of Cities, if they want to testify on something that, is there a difference between the bills on that significant? I mean, I don't really, we don't really need testimony unless there's something that is going to be hotly debated. I think we can sort of figure it out ourselves. We don't have a lot of time for testimony. Representative Wagenius.
The difference, I think, in the coal tar is we add additional money that would go out to cities for cleanup. That's the difference.
I thought we did that too. We designated some money. Correct?
We added money to a second year on some of the monies we added had last year for our study, I believe.
Yeah, it's a little different.
This is different.
They add money to it.
All right, and I think we should start with the DNR. That's going to take some time. So if we could do the DNR and have them come forward, then we'll do Bowser, and then if there's any other issues with state agencies, we'll take those next. All right, Mr. Meyer.
Madam Chair, members of the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. I have with me Director David Shad with the Fish and Wildlife Division to speak specifically to Article 1, I believe it is, the dedicated funding article. So I don't know if we want to get into that or if we want to save that till you get to that article. So you just want to hear all of our comments in general, Madam Chair?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I will just start off with Article 2, or Article 3, I guess, with the Environment and Natural Resources Provisions. This bill is primarily made up of the DNR environment policy bills that have moved through both bodies. The provisions are not that far off, DNR related wise. There are provisions that we've missed or that have been taken, set aside because of one reason or another. All I do is I ask the conference committee to try to look at the provisions that are on in the House. For example, we have the working capital account that came out in the Senate committee because of some concerns. There's some beaver damage language in the Senate bill that we took out of the House bill because of a hiccup in a committee that we want to just get through. So as you're going through conference committee, please compare those two sides of the bills. I will be talking with you individually about those specific things. Our other comments within the letter of the governor, I don't know if you want to get into that at all right now.
Now's your chance.
All right.
Now or never, I would say.
Madam Chair, that sounds great. I appreciate that. I will defer to the governor's comment letter just briefly here, Madam Chair. You've already talked about the 3M piece, but the governor does have considerable concerns about the definitions that remain in the bill on the House side. And in his letter, he states, quote, "I support the Senate position to repeal these definitions and expect the conferees will also reach this position." I know this will be discussed at length another time, so I will leave that. He also goes on to say that, "Likewise, I strongly urge you to have legislation for the dedicated funds that is separate from policy. I believe this will serve the public interest and integrity of the Constitution." The gist of that is he would prefer a clean bill just dealing with the appropriations and not the policies pieces that are still there. He goes on to talk about the hazardous waste provision and the environmental permitting, which you have talked about, and then other concerns that the agencies have had. Ms. Boyne has brought up some concerns of the PCA. One of our concerns remains within the bill, the reorganization article, Madam Chair, that is funded partially for the costs of the citizen members. This remains a largely unfunded mandate for the agencies to deal with, including MMB, dealing with the reductions that we're facing now and possible future reductions that we'll be facing before session's over with, and the inconclusive nature of the reorganization. We strongly urge you not to accept the Senate position on that. Part of the issue at hand is that it only takes small pieces of the Department of Agriculture into consideration. For a reform such as this to occur, we believe it's a position of the Pollution Control Agency as well that you need to look at the entire Department of Agriculture division, not just small pieces of it. There's a provision that the House and Senate Conference Committee on the Ag and Veterans accepted that has the DNR and Ag looking at forest pest activities, which if that goes through, we will need some substantial regulatory authority to deal with that effectively. So we have some strong concerns on that, and if we're going to put the time and effort in there, money does need to be appropriated to the agency to do that and to do it right, to look at the whole picture, Madam Chair. Going on, the other specific concerns that we have are related to Section 1, and I do have some comments, Madam Chair, from the Governor's Office of Commerce and other agencies with the energy article are not here today. They're not able to be here today. I know they're going to have some discussions with you all in the coming, probably tomorrow or tonight, about some of their concerns. But I can get into the comments that they have on that article if you want to as well, Madam Chair, once we're done. With that, I would like to turn this over to Director Shad to speak of the dedicated funding issues that we do have within the section.
Madam Chair, again, Dave Shad, Fish and Wildlife Director for Department of Natural Resources. Just a few comments, and these relate to some of the policy considerations, some of the policy language that is included in Article 1, and I'll go from front to back. Starting on page R16, line 16.8.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Representative Murphy. Could we just wait till we find it?
Okay. Page R16, starting on line 16.8, this would be of the House language. There's some language related to genetic contamination, and in the Senate, it refers to prairies. In the House, it refers to other habitats, forests and wetlands, and so forth. Genetic contamination is certainly an important consideration as we do our conservation work. There's increasing awareness of this issue and some of the concerns and problems that can come from using the wrong genetic stock, for example, to do our restoration work. But having this in law as more or less a standard really becomes an impossible thing for agencies to comply with. We do have, excuse me.
Mr. Shad.
Patrick, if you wouldn't mind if I interrupt. The Senate has the same language.
Mr. Yeah. Knopf, let me.
I'm sorry.
Please, let me ask the questions. Thank you. I was just going to say the same thing.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Everybody relax. Mr. Shad.
Yes.
Representative Murphy points out that this is identical language. Is that true? And it's the language that was approved by the Lessard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council?
Madam Chair, I apologize. You're right. It is the exact same language and I had understood that it was different language, broader language in the House, so never mind, as they say.
Never mind, all right.
Madam Chair.
On that issue.
Never mind.
On that issue, Madam Chair, because I think this is very important, because I've heard through the grapevine again that the House had added this language, and that's just not true. As many things that are said relating to stuff in this article, it's just not true.
Representative Hansen, I think we've established that, so why don't we move on?
Madam Chair, just
quickly. I've heard that too, but it's here and it's in front of our eyes, so let's just move on.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry.
Mr. Meyer.
Just on this point, the where Director Shad was going was last year the language that was passed by the council just dealt with native prairies, and we can understand that and how to deal with that. This language was put in by the council. We do have concerns that the projects that are in the bill to be appropriated, that they cannot meet this need. I mean, the classic example is when we do a shallow lake restoration. If we do that in northern Minnesota, we will not be able to plant any wild rice in that restoration because of the threat from genetic drift from a paddy rice operation onto that land. We can't guarantee that. As we do restorations on a grassland, for example, we can't guarantee that we're going to protect those restorations from genetic contamination. So while we understand it's both sides of the bill, we are just concerned that the projects that are there, if the restoration audit language would go through in this bill. So now you have the legislative auditor out trying to audit something that we believe is not achievable. So that's the point we're trying to make on
that. Isn't that the whole point of finding seeds from as close to the restoration site as possible? So then you don't have to worry about protecting it from genetic contamination if it's using the same, you know, genetic strain?
Madam Chair, that is part of that. But I had this discussion with Senate staff today. Looking at the language as it's drafted, the literal sense of that means that we need to protect, or the projectee, the grantee, will need to protect those existing stands of habitat from genetic contamination. One of the tools we use are using the local ecotype seed and using the seed source from as close as possible. But our concern is that now, 20 years from now, the legislative auditor will come back and say, there's a genetic species here that was not here before, and you have found. One of their findings will be that you did not meet this letter of the law in protecting that restoration from genetic contamination. And that's the point we're trying to make. To Representative Hansen's point, we were incorrect initially that this was just in the House language. We did correct that once we realized where the language did come from. So I do apologize that we were talking about House language at one time that was in both bills and came from the council. So I just want to set the record straight on that point as well, Madam.
I am not going to have an argument. That's the end of that discussion. Please. I just want to make that clear. We don't have a lot of time, and let's not waste it. I do think it would have been helpful if we'd had this discussion sometime in the committee process that started months ago. So let's move on.
Moving on, Madam Chair. Thank you. On page R23, and starting with the definitions, I've testified a number of times, both House and Senate, about our concerns about the definitions, and less about the wording of the definitions, but just the fact that these definitions are becoming very divisive within the conservation community and seem to be pitting interest against each other, and the fact that we've been debating them for more than a year and still haven't been able to settle on what the definition should be, I think is telling. We would prefer that the definitions not be included in statute, and instead that we all focus on desired outcomes from this funding. The Lasard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council is undergoing a planning process. Our agencies are all very involved using existing plans and the collective expertise in our agencies to define what we really want to achieve over 25 years from the Outdoor Heritage Fund, and focusing on those outcomes and what we want to achieve rather than this ongoing debate about definitions, I think would be a better use of all of our time, and we prefer to see them just taken out of statute. And I won't comment any further on those definitions, I guess. Moving on to subdivision 8 of the land management option. This would require the council to develop a method to assess future costs related to land management for lands that are acquired, and to assess an upfront fee that would be escrowed and used to pay for that ongoing management. I think this is a really important policy consideration. We typically don't do this for other areas of investment in government. When we build buildings or roads or bridges, we don't typically escrow the money for ongoing maintenance and replacement of that infrastructure. And I think it's an important policy question of whether we should do that for our conservation infrastructure, if there's a need to do that or not. We are working very hard as part of the proposals we bring to the Lessard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council to identify ongoing restoration and management costs as part of our proposals, and we'll continue to do that. We do think that it's very, very difficult to predict long-term what those costs might be. There are many variables, climate change, invasive species, man-made and natural disasters that can make it challenging to identify what those costs are. Further, we typically don't manage and assess costs based on individual parcels. For example, if we buy a 40-acre parcel, if it's part of a larger 2,000-acre complex, we would manage that entire complex with that 40 acres contained in it, and identifying the cost that would be attributed to that small 40-acre piece now and into the future, and separate that out from the costs associated with managing that larger complex would be very, very challenging. And so we believe this is problematic. We'll certainly work with the council and others if it's the legislature's desire to develop this system, make sure that these costs are as accurate as possible, but we do think it will be a challenge. Moving on, on page 24, the lands in public domain provision, starting on line 24.6 on the House side. This could create some unintended consequences. We have had a number of situations. We typically don't buy land in fee title that is already covered by, for example, a long-term conservation easement, but we have had a number of situations where a large property might have very small portions of that property under easement. For example, there might be a stream buffer or a wetland that was restored on that property that is under easement, and trying to separate out acquisition of that larger parcel from those portions of that parcel that are covered by easement would be problematic. It could require separate appraisals and transactions, and so because of some of that complexity, we understand the concern and don't necessarily disagree with what's behind this concern, but we think looking at this on a case-by-case basis and not having an absolute restriction on that sort of thing would provide that flexibility that agencies and organizations need, I believe. Finally, on page R35, this is the restoration audit language. We'd certainly concur with the desire here to ensure that the restoration work that we do is of the highest quality, that it's based on the best possible science, that it complies with all the statutory regulations, that it's based on best management practices, that sort of thing. But we think that these site-based audits really don't help us get there. There are many provisions already in law that I think get us to where we need to be as far as high-quality restorations. We think if an audit would be helpful, it would be more at the program level, looking at agency or organization prairie restoration programs, for example. Do they have best management practices in place? Do they use local ecotype seed? Do they have a schedule for maintaining and managing those lands? Do they have funding identified to conduct that management? Those kinds of things. And focusing at that programmatic level seems more appropriate. These sites, they're very dynamic. They change from year to year. In many cases, These restorations take many years before they can finally be judged successful or not, looking back over that long period of time and judging the goals and objectives and the success or failure of that restoration seems to us to be very challenging. So we think redirecting this language to more of a program-type audit rather than a site-based audit would be more helpful.
Right.
With that, we'll work with all of you to try to address these issues in any way we can in the coming days. So.
Thank you. I know we had some hands up. Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm pleased to hear from the DNR that there are some places where you at least have some agreement with our intent, or you understand why the House has tried to do some of the things that we've tried to do here, even though you may not, or you may see some problems, or you may have some concerns with the language as it is. I guess I would encourage testifiers and Madam Chair, Madam Chairs, as we go through this process, that we should try to fix these things and find ways to address the concerns of testifiers, the intent of both bodies, the Senate and the House, with the differences that they have on both sides, instead of just saying, reject this, reject this, no, we can't do this, no, we can't do that. So I look forward to hearing more from testifiers on some of these things and possible resolutions that you have. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Did you have your hand up? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually have a question for Commissioner Meyer on a different piece on R3, on Article 3, if possible.
Back to the policy stuff?
This is on the utility line issue.
Madam Chair, if we're done with Director Shad, I'd like to pull up Kathy Lewis to help us with those questions.
All right, let's wait a moment. We may not be. Representative Wagenius, we'll come back to that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I have two different questions, and I'm looking at the land management option portion here, where you said that would be a challenge to me. And I'm hoping that we can figure out a way you can meet that challenge. And here's why. As I look at the budgets in DNR, most of the general fund money is in forestry and in parks and trails. And if you do not rise to the challenge, and we have to take money from someplace to do land management of lands we are acquiring, then there are only two places I can see that it will come from, and that's forestry and parks and trails. So what we're doing is we're shifting resources here, because we know that we're not going to get new resources, and we know that we're going to get cuts next year, big ones. So I think that does pose additional challenges for all of us, and this is one of the challenges. Do you understand why then we put this in here?
Madam Chair, Representative Wagenius, yes, and I acknowledge it is an important policy consideration. Do we forego some restoration enhancement protection work now by, you know, escrowing money to ensure that we can manage those lands in the long term? Or do we try to accomplish as much as we can now with on-the-ground work with the hope that money will materialize in the future to take care of these lands? And again, it's an important policy consideration that, and we haven't taken this approach in other areas of government, to my knowledge. So,
Representative Wagenius,
I think we're not communicating very well here. The reason we would want to escrow some money here is so that we don't take money from forestry to manage these lands. We don't take money from parks and trails to manage these lands. That is kind of the fundamental issue, because I don't see us coming up with great new sources of income. So we are going to, within DNR, have to do some shifting. And that's that's the issue, the policy challenge we all have to deal with. So that's why this challenge is a little bit different than the one of hoping for new monies into the system. It's really shifting within the system. So that's one question. And the second question I had, you, when you were talking about climate change and invasive species, do you believe that some of the money from the Heritage Fund can be used for keeping invasive species down?
Madam Chair, Representative Wagenius, if it was necessary for enhancing or restoring the habitat to achieve the goals for that project, I believe it would be. Sure.
And if I could just follow up, if we had a parcel of land that did not need restoring or did not need enhancing, but needed to put up a fish barrier because there was a very clean lake and a lake with carp in it, and we didn't want that those carp to move from this lake to that lake, we can't use money for enhancing or restoring. Can we use money for protecting to put in that fish barrier? Mr. Shad?
Madam Chair, Representative Wagenius, I kind of... It's hard to deal with hypotheticals. We typically use conservation dollars for things like fish barriers to prevent movement of carp and other rough fish into shallow lakes, for example, that we're restoring. And in most cases, our work has involved actual restoration. We're taking a degraded lake and putting some structures in and you know, developing the capacity to actually eliminate the rough fish, and then once we do that, prevent future reinfestation of rough fish. I think in that context, it would certainly be very appropriate and consistent with, you know, current conservation practice in the state.
Is that what you're working on? So, consistent with current conservation practices, do you prevent good lakes from being infested?
Madam Chair, Representative Wagenius, you know, that's that wouldn't certainly be an enhancement. It certainly wouldn't be a restoration. I guess that gets to the debate around definitions and the word protection. Certainly, if in a very broad view of protection, that would be allowable.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, just to go to Representative Wagenius's first part of her question dealing with the land management option and kind of with the land management option and kind of going back to Representative Morgan's comments, I think the language that we have in Article 3 dealing with the long-range budget analysis provides us a great stepping stone to get to this. I think the language here dealing with the land management option may be a bit premature until we have a better handle on what those actual costs might be. That long-range budget analysis, which we've agreed to do, it's the same language on both sides, will provide us with a lot of the background and information, the data that we'll need, I think, to get to this other point at some point in time. But the dates aren't going to line up right. The concern, going back to David Chad's concerns, is we don't deal with the roads. There is no escrow account for road repair or bridge repair or buildings when we build buildings. So I think the concerns that I've heard from some other people in the conservation community about this is, why is this singled out with these funds when we aren't looking at some kind of escrow account for any other type of capital projects that we do? So I agree with the concept, and we need to come back, and we'll be presenting this long-range budget analysis, which provides us the needs, basically, for all of the work that we do and the spreadsheets that will be there. So we'll have a better understanding on those costs that are out there. But to get to this point, to do both of these at the same time may be premature, and that's one of our concerns as well.
But you're not doing it. It's a council.
All right, I see a lot of hands. I'm trying to go in order.
I believe I saw Senator Chaudhry, then Representative Hansen.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Mr. Shad, on that Article 1, Section 2, when you're protecting, enhancing, or restoring, does one always employ a practice of retaining water as long as practicable in that project? Is that always done?
Madam Chair, Senator Chaudhry, the language you're speaking of, I think, is on page R16, line 16.18. It requires practices to retain water on east land for as long as practicable. And we do have some concerns with this. It may not be consistent with the purpose of the easement, for example. It may actually be damaging to the habitat purpose, for example. This also may be a disincentive for landowners to consider enrolling lands in easement programs if they knew that they needed to take some steps to retain water on their land. So again, I think the intent here that we use conservation lands to improve water quality, abate flooding, that sort of thing is certainly appropriate, but having this language in there may reduce that flexibility, and it may be inappropriate for some lands and some practices.
And Madam Chair, on a couple questions on the Section 3. Do any other areas of government require escrow funds to cover future costs?
Madam Chair, Senator Chaudhry, not to my knowledge, but I don't have an exhausting knowledge of state government finances. So.
No, I thought in our, maybe it's in the RFP, I'm looking at Bill Becker and Mike Kilgore, that we have some kind of, in our criteria for grants, and the Lessard Stamps Council will require that there be some, I can't remember if it's funding set aside for restoration for any project. So there's already, and maybe, Mr. Kilgore, could you help us with that?
Madam Chair and members, Mike Kilgore, Chair of the Lessard Stamps Outdoor Heritage Council. Madam Chair, you're correct. What we require in any proposal that came to the council in our call for requests was that they identify not only the immediate restoration work that would go on the property, but also identify the type, the extent, and the funding sources for the ongoing work of that property to maintain that habitat.
So it would be identifying the funds, not necessarily have that be part of the grant, but if it's not part of the grant, it would have to be identified to exist somewhere else.
That's correct, and that is to be included in the accomplishment plan, which, of course, as in the law, as currently drafted, would have to be approved before the money is spent.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That helps. And then maybe Mr. Kilgore could stay up there. What is the council's opinion on reserving money for future costs such as PILT?
Madam Chair and Senator Chaudhry, the council has not taken a formal position on escrowing money for any particular project, whether it be for PILT or ongoing habitat work. We have, as you likely know, requested some interpretation from the Attorney General's office early on after we were formed about the use of the Outdoor Heritage Fund to pay for PILT. Our interpretation as a council is that it is not allowable given the constitutional requirements for how the fund is to be used. We have talked about making sure that we have ongoing management and maintenance costs for the property. We have not built that into our requests, but we certainly have talked about the need for that. But I want to call your attention to the fact that a number of our funding recommendations, the programs, in fact, do address the very issue you're wrestling with. For example, we are funding over 20,000 acres of restoration work for the prairies for the Department of Natural Resources in this bill. So we are dealing with that on a programmatic level at this point. And so my personal opinion as chair is that if you're asking about the management cost issue, it may be a bit premature in the life of the fund, because that's what we're trying to address as we go through our work, not only looking at protection needs, but restoration and enhancement needs. And 75% of the acres that are being affected in this year's set of recommendations are for enhancement and restoration. So we are addressing that issue directly through funding.
Well, then, Madam Chair, Mr. Kilgore, how would one go about, or is it even possible, to assign management costs, future management costs, when you're kind of, in some instances, building together or trying to unite together maybe a patchwork of parcels, if you're trying to put together larger landscapes or complexes of habitat? Is that possible, and if so, how?
Madam Chair and Senator Chaudhry, I think it would be extremely challenging to hit it on the mark because of things that are largely outside our control, whether it be a dry year, a very wet fall, a number of things that will affect the quality of the habitat, things that are unforeseen. I think those would be the biggest challenges. Again, one thing that the committee might want to consider is looking at that as we get towards the end of the 25-year framework to set up some way of continuing to funding that restoration or that enhancement work, in that case, beyond the life of the fund. But our intent as a council, at least early on, is to make sure that our funding recommendations include that restoration and the enhancement work as well as the other protection work.
I have one last question for Mr. Shad, Madam Chair. Thanks for your indulgence. When the DNR, and obviously you can only speak to the DNR, but to your knowledge elsewhere, if you were to, refers to Section 4, if you're trying to put together, again, fragmented lands, do any of them, could any of them be part, already be owned by another political subdivision or even the DNR? How would this Section 4 work in some of the projects you've done to date?
Madam Chair, Senator Chaudhry, I mentioned earlier one example of how that would work, where we're buying a parcel from a property that has at least part of it that's under a conservation easement. We have had other projects that we've worked on, for example, a large wetland restoration that might be owned by multiple landowners, and in order to fully restore that wetland, you need to either have the land under easement or fee title from all of these various landowners, and one landowner can more or less block the project. And so you could run into a situation where if that land was already under an easement, a conservation easement, but it didn't provide for the wetland restoration, it couldn't end up blocking the project. It could actually be owned by a public entity, and it was purchased by that entity with funds that are dedicated for some purpose other than a wetland restoration practice. And in that case, we would buy that land from them, even though they are another public entity, and they would, they would use the revenue from that, the proceeds from that, to replace that land for that dedicated purpose. So, again, there's a lot of complexity out there when you're dealing with lands and landowners, and over time, as we get more of these programs in place, I think it's going to be more difficult to find land that's completely free of any kind of state obligation. And then one final consideration I might throw out there. We do have a lot of privately owned land where the state owns the underlying mineral rights, and I think there's a question on whether or not this language would, whether that would constitute ownership by the state, and if we would be prevented from buying that surface right in fee or easement if the state already owned that those mineral rights. And that's a question perhaps council could advise us on. But
that, just for anyone who's familiar, is the restoration audit language or something similar being proposed for the LCMR projects as well in this, or is it already in there?
I think this applies to all state funds. Is that true?
Madam Chair, I'm just seeing Environmental and Natural Trust Fund being crossed out, as well as state-issued bonds.
Representative Lemus?
I think Representative Hanson.
Madam Chair and Senator Chaudhry, that was stricken because of input with the conservation groups who wanted it to only apply two nights ago, because they only wanted this restoration audit to apply to the constitutional funds. So the state bonds and LCCMR funds that were in the bill that came to the floor, that was stricken based on input from conservation groups. I can give you the names in the room if you'd like them.
Okay, I can add to this. Thank you.
I think there was a concern that some of the heritage funds might be used to audit other areas like LCCMR, and nobody ever thought that that should be the case. LCCMR funds should audit LCCMR, and we haven't set up that yet, but I think that would be appropriate.
Madam Chair, are you saying that this similar language is not in the current LCMR bill?
No, well, I think maybe we should put it in.
I just want a clarification here. So I know, and I'm sorry, we're all tired, but Mr. Kadoff points out on page R18, paragraph H, the requirement that's already in law. No, this is new language. This is new language.
Madam Chair, it was carried in last year's riders also.
Okay. So it's the same as last year, and so it's not codified, but it requires that an applicant for funding from the Heritage Fund has to have an analysis of where the money will come from for restoration. I think if I'm just paraphrasing that.
It's just an analysis.
An analysis. And so I'm going back to what Mr. Kilgore said about what's in our request for proposals. Does that require the funding actually be made available, or is it just a requirement that there be a plan? You answered that already, but I guess I didn't focus on.
Madam Chair, Mr. Kilgore informs me it's a plan.
It's a plan, so it doesn't actually require the funds be part of. Okay, so that is a difference from the language, the proposal here in the House that requires funds to be set aside. But maybe we should look at that language that the council uses, because it's not, I think it's been applied similarly, but I guess we should get to the bottom of that. There is a difference there. All right. Representative Hanson, you had your hand up earlier, and then Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah.
One question was, or a response was on the point that Commissioner or somebody had made about, do we escrow anything else? Actually, we escrow for bonding, kind of, with HEPR. We have a set-aside for capital projects and buildings where we set aside funds in each bonding bill in the education. And then last year, we created a statute of NAPR for natural resources to set up a fund for dealing with some of those capital investments. So we've been doing some of that work as well. I want to get back to the question of definitions and Director Shad's testimony. And Commissioner Meyer, back to a letter from last fall.
Representative Hanson, I think some people are having trouble hearing you. Thank you. That's right. You have a bad voice right now, so just do your best.
Commissioner Meyer, last fall, I think you provided a letter where it said that the DNR had concerns about the definitions and statute, and one of the concerns was the cross-referencing or referencing of where they applied to. And I believe that the amendment that was put on in the House did clarify that application. And so that issue shouldn't have gone away if that was one of the, on that particular point, we removed that point of contention in terms of the application of where the definitions apply. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanson, I don't have that letter in front of me, but my memory, I'll try to remember those points that were in the letter. One was the location being in 84.02 and in Chapter 3.3006, which a user of the Outdoor Heritage Fund or the Parks Fund or the Clean Water Fund probably wouldn't look at, was one of our concerns. The other concern was that if definitions were to be developed, that they be developed with a group of conservation professionals kind of going to Director Shad's point of view, and come up with definitions that everyone could agree with. So one of our concerns is where they're located. The House amendment took care of some of that. They did remove those definitions, and they put them in the right place. The new definitions you need to note, members, are in 97A.056, which is the Outdoor Heritage Fund. So for that, we do thank you. We do have some concerns about the language that has been used in those terms.
And then to follow up, and I'll lean forward a little bit. So then what I've just heard you say and what I heard Director Shad say is that the issue here is either that we get a consensus on something that everybody agrees with, or we need to take these out because there's controversy, because groups and individuals are upset, because they're controversial or there's controversy. I didn't hear any discussion about science. I didn't hear any discussion about applicability. But I heard it's either everybody agrees on something, or we have to take them out, and everybody agrees we need to take them out because they're controversial. And I think what we have here under the language that's in front of us right now is very similar language to what was in a request for proposal. We've heard a lot of discussion about changes to the definitions, but the legislature hasn't changed anything that was written in the Constitution. And what was put into statute was an initial act. What people are talking about are definitions that were approved after about 3 minutes of debate in the Lasard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council as a request for proposal for projects. And during that debate, it was said we could change them for the next round of debate. And now, that request for proposal is being held as the standard of what people voted on. When the people didn't vote on that standard, they voted for the Constitution, and 1.6 million people voted for the Constitution, not just conservation groups or conservation professionals or lobbyists or political action committees. So what I'm hearing from the DNR is that we must change stuff because people are upset. And everything we do in this building, somebody gets upset. Everything we do in this building, interest groups weigh in on one side or the other. Is it the testimony of the DNR that we must change this because interest groups are upset and we must change it?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Meyer.
Members. One of the perplexing things to me about this whole definitions debate that's been going on for a long time is that the voters a long time ago passed not once but twice a constitutional amendment dealing with the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund, which had very similar terms, which there was never any discussion about definitions for those funds. There are no statutory definitions related to in 116P for the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund. I think the proposals that are dealt with through that process, go through the RFP, and the council members look at what those terms mean. Another letter that we had sent last year at some point in time in session talked about the science behind the definitions, talked about conservation biologists, and looked at some of the discussions that have been going on for a long time within the academic community about definitions and about these terms. And perhaps Mr. Kilgore could put on his academic cap and talk about those debates within the academic community about these types of terms. But we did reference in that letter that you need, if there are going to be definitions put in place, they need to be developed and adopted and approved with not only the legislature and the stakeholders, but also the conservation biologists, not only within the Department of Natural Resources and Bowser and other places, but with academia. I mean, that's where we're at. Representative Hansen, you bring up a good point. Terms that were used to do an RFP, to issue an RFP, all of a sudden have become lightning rods around this place for a long time. And they didn't have a lot of debate. The language that was negotiated with the House on whatever day that was done without using. I don't think there was anybody that had a biologist degree that was working on those definitions. We just, if people want to have, I meant on well, we'll get into that later if we need to. If people want to have terms defined in statute that deal with these concepts, these terms, we need to work with the group of us and the professionals that deal with these terms, not only the groups who are looking into it and the stakeholders, but really I've never heard any scientific testimony in Representative Murphy's committee anywhere about the definition terms that are there. So, Representative Hansen, I'm not saying our position is get rid of the definitions because a group of sportsmen don't want them or we have problems with them. What we're saying is it didn't make sense to have them put where they were last session, and I do appreciate you taking care of that. But for the definitions, if people desire to have definitions put in the statute, let's develop them with some kind of consensus. Or let's look at how these other types of funds are used and talk about it within the context of the projects, of the outcomes, and within the RFP. And that's our position. The department did not write a bunch of letters this session on this issue. I think people know where we stand. If people need to see copies of the letters we used last session, I can certainly get those out. But that's where our position is. It's if we're going to do this, let's do it right, the right way, and do it with the right people. So, thank you, Madam.
All right. There's three hands raised, and I suspect that this discussion could go on for quite a while. And I'm not trying to cut anyone off. Hopefully, we'll have a chance to do this. But it's almost 5 o'clock, and I had proposed we would be ending soon. So I think I'm going to use my prerogative as a chair to make my little statement and ask my question, and then I think we may want to draw this to a close for today. So here's what I want to ask. I want to ask the DNR, and I'm going to ask everybody who comes up with an interest in this issue, which is more important to you? Getting the definitions resolved this year or passing a $58 million funding bill so that we can protect habitat? And that's not a rhetorical question. I would like an answer.
Madam Chair, I do understand your point.
It's a question.
We would like to do both, and I think we can.
And, you know, Mr. Meyer, thank you, and probably most people will say that, but not everybody will say that. And I guess I'm disturbed to hear some people say that the definitions are more important. And also, I have a very pragmatic part about me, and that is the part that is really concerned that we're supposed to finish this conference committee by tomorrow night, and by Senator Pogemiller saying very clearly that there will not be any bills on the Senate floor after Wednesday except for the major budget bills. And I think he's pretty serious about that. And so my concern is, you know, what the voters really wanted us to do was to start protecting habitat and not to spend all this time arguing. And it's really, I'm just getting really fed up with this argument. And I understand it's important to people for a lot of good reasons. So I'm not trying to minimize the importance of the things we're talking about. But I also feel that with a week left in the session and a few short days to finish our work, I'm very concerned that we're going to get deja vu all over again. This is what we spent all our time talking about a year ago. And I just want to get our bill passed and get that funding out the door. I think I'll be very clear. That is my number one priority. And let me just say one more time about the definitions. Honestly, whether we can have statutory definitions in place, but the council is an advisory group who we have created and charged with making judgments and making recommendations to us, and they are free to do that using a narrower definition than what we have in statute. And I don't know if there's any dispute about that, but that's how I read the law, that it really doesn't matter whether we say one thing or another in statute, as long as the council has the right, because of their statutory authority, to have a narrower view of the Constitution.
And if anybody can tell me I'm wrong, I want to hear that. But they have the right to have a narrower view and interpretation of the Constitution. And the only way we're going to change that is to change who, you know, the appointments of who's on it. That's how we set it up. And so I'm not sure why everyone is fixated on spending so much time on this. I'm really struggling with it. And I know it's very important to a lot of people. But to me, $58 million that we agree on is a lot more important. So members, as long as I've got the gavel, I really don't want to spend the rest of the week arguing about something that we may not be able to resolve in the next few days. And so I'm just going to lay that out there. At some point, I appreciate the work the House has done to try to find a compromise. I think that's really helpful and is long overdue. But at some point, we need to say, members, let's just, if we can't resolve this, and if we don't have time to have that big discussion, let's move the money and move on and defer it till summer and fall and next year. So I'm just laying that out there. That's going to be my intention at some point, and because it just may be that we can't fix it right now. Okay, I'm done with my sermon, and members, I know if I start calling on everyone, we'll continue this debate. So I apologize, Senator Chaudhry. I think we need to decide if we're going to call the meeting to an end tonight. And I'd like to ask Representative Murphy if she has any comments about our next steps or anything else.
I do. The Cultural and Outdoor, or the Conference Committee on Senate File 3275 will convene tomorrow at 3:30 in Room 5 of the State Office Building. The House will have an offer. We expect an offer back at that time. I know that you cannot immediately offer back, but you've got a pretty good idea of what your first offer is going to be, and that'll probably fit in pretty good with what our first offer will be, because usually they're not much different than the sames or similars, and maybe one or two little things. I will be in my office at 2:30 to meet with anyone that wants to talk, anyone that feels that it's important for them to give testimony, or that are available to answer questions of the committee members who wants to give statements in public. I want to know who they are before the meeting starts. It was my intent to work today and into the evening when the day started. And I was here at 9 o'clock. I know many of the people that live in this area have plans for tomorrow. And so did I. But my plans were north. And so I'll have until 3:30 tomorrow afternoon to take a nap. And that will probably serve us all very well.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. I appreciate your decisiveness, even though none of us are happy about Mother's Day meetings. It is what we have to do. So
with that, and I apologize that I can't work into the evening tonight and that we weren't able to start earlier today because of lots of schedules beyond all of our controls. So I'm going to invite my members to, I will be here in my office before 3:30 tomorrow if anyone would like to discuss this. But, and if you...
3:46.
If anyone has a scheduling problem that would mean they can't be here, please let us know. All right, with that, 3:30 in room 5
yes.
of the State Office Building.
If there's any change, it will be on the website.
Thank you. The meeting's adjourned.